support local businesses, and I'll assume you all went to Amy's, or one of the local businesses, but I won't push it.
Where is it?
Amy's is on 9th Avenue, off of 47th Street.
What, AMYF?
Yeah, Amy's Bread.
She does sell
homemade marshmallow. So I want to let everybody know that, first of all, there were catalogs in the back. There are two flyers that I have, and I wanted to announce Laura's event at Omega, because even though I have other events, Laura has flyers for another event with Dan up at Omega. So, Laura, wave your hand. But everybody come to Laura afterwards and get one of her flyers.
It's a 6-week course in eco-literacy with John Todd and a whole bunch of other faculty.
The John Todd from the John Todd machine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you could work out a deal for me, I would.
Ice cream will be incredibly inexpensive. It's $25 a day. That includes the tuition, the meals. We basically worked our whole systems in our organization to make it really inexpensive. So it's going to be biomimicry teachers, it's permaculture, Bill Reed from Genesis. It's just like a host of incredible teachers, and it's camping, meals, tuition, material cost, everything for $25 a day.
What is that? I gave you a plug.
June 16th to July 26th.
Is that one of your flyers? The flyers are on the
and Dan's
going to
be doing a piece on soil living.
That's great. So I want to let everybody know that I'm going to be finally sending out a feedback form on this event and on other events. I want to know people's interest in things like spirituality, eco-villages, indigenous communities, consensus. What you want from the series, because we tried to do this as part of TNG, as part of our education process, and it's happening too frequently, maybe, or we just don't know what people want. I hope people want more than the practical. They want some of the other sides of the community building, but you've got to tell me. So I will, if I'm feeling good, I'll hound you if you don't get the feedback form. Dan is coming back. So here's what I want to tell the room is, for those who have taken the class, they can sign up for it again for $100. That's like a lifetime guarantee for whenever. That's my choice. He has nothing to do with it. But I feel like that's fair to people, if you know, because then you get a chance to sit in with him again and take it. And TNG has to pay for the room and pay Dan, and just that's affordable. What we're going to do with Dan is bring him in first in September to do another two-hour evening, like we did last year as a kind of promotional thing. And then what I wanted to do for this was, originally I was trying to attract eaters as well as growers. But out of the 700 membership from TNG, I think only 5 people were interested, because they felt that they weren't growing food and they had no interest in understanding this. So Dan is willing to do a one-day workshop on how to address this to make people who eat it come into this, because especially people from TNG and TFC, that's the group that brings the food in, it's really important to kind of trace it back, like tracing back all the history from Monsanto and stuff. So Dan's going to do a one-day thing for that, which we'll label under for eaters. So I need help from you guys promoting that. And then Dan's going to run the two-day workshop in a real schedule, which either means he'll come in for the day one in November, and then we'll do day two much earlier than we did now. We kind of felt this was later in the season. So I'll have an early bird special for that, but I have to always know I got to pay Dan, I got to pay for the room, and TNG has to be able to function as an organization, just like anybody here is trying to function. I have 2 events that I'm heavily invested in the back, and I really appreciate it. There's a yellow flyer and a red flyer. The red flyer is a 4-day event in Washington, D.C. It's about sociocracy. And Jamie understands the concept, but if you're going to do an eco village, or you're going to do a business or a workers co-op, or you're just going to be with friends, this is a methodology that's based on consensus, and it's how businesses and things are run in the Netherlands and in Amsterdam. It's very successful because it flattens out the communication from the top level of the company to the bottom level. There's a constant stream of communication flowing throughout. So if you guys want to do it, before you build your bond, try to build a way of talking to each other. And I recommend that particular workshop because I've taken it when I went to the communities conference last year. And everything points to that 9 out of 10 communities that Dan is telling us to go upstate and build, they all fail because there's not a lot of working agreements and communication going on between people. The Yellow Flyer is more to my heart because I'm one of the organizers for that. It's the second annual event, very much along the lines of your thing. It's called The Age of Limits. And one of the books that Dan has is by a woman named Danella Meadows. She wrote a book with two other people called Limits to Growth. She's a systems person, which is what Dan has the book there about. So Age of Limits is an event where it's not a conference in the usual sense. We have a very limited number of speakers who are both authors, and they are participants, and they are, what is the word we came up with?
Practitioners.
They are practitioners. So every one of them is either farming or doing something. And their books, they have made choices in their lives similar to Dan, someone like Guy McPherson, someone like Carolyn Baker, someone like John Michael Greer, and I have two of the books at the back. Carolyn's going to do ritual workshops there, for very connected to indigenous mourning cycles, and talking about the concept of love throughout the whole thing. So the event is a chance for people to come together in a really great, bountiful, beautiful, natural environment and get to meet with these people and to meet with each other because it's not packed with 6 million events competing with each other. There's like one or two events and then there's a lot of space and time between each event. It's called the Age of Limits. It's on one side of the Yellow Flyer. The other side is actually a scaled-down permaculture course. And that's 5 days for $375. Including your accommodations and your food. And I think that that's very much along your lines. Is I tried to run affordable permaculture courses. I can have a conversation about what I think about permaculture, but that's a separate thing. But her name is Patricia Allison, and she comes from Earth Haven, which is an eco village down in North Carolina. She's had a lot of experience in this, so I encourage having women teach this, and I would love to get people of color to teach this. But that's an opportunity before the actual gathering to spend 5 days there and then to look at the gathering. But whether the gathering is your cup of tea or not, you want to have these conversations. I need you to help me just send it out when I send out the email. Because this is not a New York thing. This is a regional thing. And these are global questions and global issues. And so I don't really personally care if you come or not. But if you could send it out to people, that's the real phone tree that I need. So you guys are my connections to people I don't need to know, want to know, but wherever you send it, it could link. We only started promoting that event last year, like 4 weeks before, and we sold out. We had 168 people that showed up for the 3-day event.
Do you have a Facebook page, Philip?
I don't have a Facebook page.
I see how it's doing. Is extremely important, and most of us are quite adept at that. So I just want to sort of run through a number of basic things to look for and to be sensitive to and to attune to. And if you were to, you know, take your time and you go out with the connectivity meter once a week and your cartometer to actually look at the plants and pay attention to the nuances of how they're growing, you can rapidly learn a lot. A very important information about where the plants are at, and just about really being present with them. I would suggest that anybody who knows how to read body language should be able to read plant. Yes? All right. You can read body language, you can read plant. The same skill set, the same, you know, attunement and sensitivity. So, for me, the first part in actually seeing what's going on with the plants is remembering to stop and pay attention. In most cases, we're out doing this, we're out doing that. Perhaps it's not the same with people that have relatively small gardens, but generally there's something to do, and there's not, and we just never forget to stop and just take in the scene and see and sort of stand back and see what's really going on from a centered sort of centered. What's the word? State. Perspective. So. the first stop, and just open yourself up, you know, even mentally, internally, you know, however you want to do it for yourself, ask, how's it going, guys? How you doing? You know, just open the conversation, not necessarily expecting a response, but a lot of people get it. So, you left. The coolest people are the people out in the, when you go out for a field walk, who say, they want this. And I'm like, how did you know that? Well, I heard something. There are people who can hear the plants, right? I mean, that's like, you know, it's no big deal. In the olden days, everybody knew how to do that. And the rest of us have been trained to use our brains and not our whole body, our other subtle senses. And so we're disconnected from it. I'd like to make the reference to, you know, sociologists and anthropologists when they go around and, you know, say they got in Brazil asking the indigenous tribesmen, how do you know that this leaf and that root will cure this ailment? Logical question. And then, you know, indigenous tribesmen say, well, we asked the plants, what would you do? Mm-hmm. Oh, silly people. And I think, you know, the same questions asked in the Aborigines in Australia, same answer. Tribesmen in Africa, Inuit in, you know, Alaska. Indigenous cultures all over the world have the same answer, right? When we asked the plants, and they told us. So if we were theoretically scientists and using data to guide our decision-making process, and we had 20 data points, and 19 of them were in a line, and one of them was an outlier, what would the scientists do with that data point?
Throw it out.
Yeah. So if our culture is the only one that says we can't talk to plants, who's right and who's wrong? From my perspective, that's the nature of things. And just because we don't know how to, doesn't mean we can't. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that says we can. And it's right there close to the surface of a lot of people. It's quite natural. So if you just open up and express the intention, just be receptive, you may find communication beginning to occur. Whether you have just an idea pops through your head. For me, I hear like lyrics will start to play in my head. You know, like, a song lyric goes over and over in your head. If you actually listen to that lyric, what is that actual lyric? It may have some very interesting connection to, you know, mulching the tomatoes or pruning them or something. So there's really interesting ways that things just happen to happen. So what's happening? I'm not going to say exactly what it is, but there's being open and being receptive is I think, a very good idea. And just to throw some words out here, I got these words, sentience, intuition, spirits, divas, kinesthetics. You know, there's various modes and practices that which people can, you know, have been can train to understand these things. My experience is that if I was to go to the bar to watch a football game and have a couple beers and, you know, TV to watch football, and I say something about having a gut feeling about something, that's totally safe, right? You can say gut feeling to anybody. Yeah? So, whether you want to call it gut feeling or plant, you know, divas or nature spirits or intuition, whatever your words are, whatever your mode, whatever's comfortable to you, I think, you know, everybody's got a word that's kind of safe that they know what I'm, hopefully they know what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. It doesn't have to be other. It doesn't have to be, you know, sort of different and strange. It can just be part of what it actually is, part of what we naturally, who we naturally are, what we naturally are. So with that sort of at least construct there for you, I'm just going to run through a long list here of things, technical things to look for. For starters, are the new growth tips standing erect? Does the new leaves, the top of the plant, are they standing up straight and true and strong and confident and excited about life? Or are they kind of hanging, placidly, just a week? What's the body language of those new leaf tips? Are they just turgid, full of energy, or are they just, or are they flaccid? I mean, this the nuances of that, just the angle of the leaf can tell you a lot. It's body language. Does somebody have energy and vigorous, or are they kind of slumped? Right? You can tell a lot. Do the honeybees work the flowers vigorously? Do the, if you have bees or you have pollinators in general, are they, you know, ignoring your squash and fighting over your tomato flowers, or are they ignoring all your crops and going over to the clover in the lawn? they can see the relative value of the pollen and the flowers, and they can discern whether it's worth harvesting for them or not. We think it's a tomato flower. They say, decent, I'm going to harvest these guys over here. So you can, you know, watch nature interacting and see what she's telling you. Yes?
And would they put the bees on the property so they can pollinate?
So they can pollinate. People seem to think that bees are necessary. And my perspective, they aren't from here. And there's plenty of people from here that can already do it. And I'm not sure what your native pollinator situation is like in the middle of the city, but I have never found it was necessary to have honeybees. Honey is nice, and, you know, we cook with it and stuff, but I think for me that the most important thing is to see if you can build the peripheral, you know, just what is the other part of the property that's not garden? Does that have perennials? Does that have like a hedgerow? Does it have, you know, herbs and flowers and you know, nuts and shrubs and things like that? Because if you can have environment for a lot of those native pollinators in close proximity to your I don't think it's necessary. Certainly not a bad thing to do, but there's a lot of, I mean, honeybees are, they're basically like hybrids.
No harm from the bees.
Harm from the bees? No, I think they're going to be beneficial. The question is whether you can keep them alive. And most people don't seem to have very good success keeping them alive. So they spend a lot of money, you know, buying them in, you know, boxes and taking care of them, and they die. And then they spend some more money to buy them and take care of them, and they die. And, you know, it's a nice idea, but we've got a lot of toxins in the environment, a lot of electromagnetic pollution that's really difficult for them, low-brix flowers. I mean, they have environmental conditions that are very stressful, so I would say that you shouldn't expect your bees to thrive until you've got your land up to a basic level of functionality. But, you know, if you're doing just a teeny little garden, you're just going to have a hard time providing everything that they need to thrive. Up in Vermont, in general. Is the plant growing rapidly, or is the plant staying still? When you put in your seedlings in the springtime and you see them sit there, people, I'm sure, have this experience where you just put your broccoli in and it just sits there for a week, and it sits there for another week, and then the seedlings come and eat it all up. You see that happen?
Yeah.
Yeah, too many times. I mean, when I was a kid, my mother was like, we're not going to grow brassicas in the spring because we can't. We couldn't get the brassicas to grow before they got eaten alive. So you should not see your plants standing still. Every day that you come and look at them and see that they're not growing is a day you could do something to help them grow. So these are things to watch and to pay attention to. If you walk past the broccoli patch and it hasn't moved in 5 days, you didn't have a productivity meter, you didn't have a defect number, you know, feed it something. Try to see what's going wrong and address it. Give it a little bit of attention. Are stems solid or hollow? You would like to have solid stems in all of your crops, that sometimes happens, most times it doesn't. But that's something realistically you can do, break off a little branch and look at it, see if it's hollow or solid. What weed families are dominant? You know, just sort of paying attention, do I have more grass weeds here? Do I have more, suckering type weeds over here? Do I have, what are the basic families of weeds, and what are the maybe environmental conditions that I've created to cause this family of weeds to thrive as opposed to that family of weeds? Different, you know, grasses like quackgrass will thrive in a different environment than pigweed and ranch water. And they all have their own natural environmental conditions, and you can actually read the environment to see what's wrong by looking at what weed families are present. How many flowers are setting per bunch? If yield matters to people, this is a good thing to pay attention to. For starters, how many flowers are there per bunch? So if you've got a tomato plant, is it putting out 4 flowers per bunch, or 6 flowers per bunch, or 2 flowers per bunch? Because if you want to get a good yield, and it's only putting out 2 flowers, you're going to have a rough time. So these things usually change over time. You usually start with 4 or 5 or 6 flowers per bunch and proceed downward to 1 or 2 at the end of the season, based on the level of energy, nutrition available to the plant. You can watch that change over time and note it and reverse it if you pay attention. How thick are the stems? How thick are the calyxes? How thick are the leaves? You want to have thick stems. You want to have thick calyxes. Calyx is that stem between the fruit and the branch, like the little stem on the apple, right? This guy right here, that's a calyx. tomatoes have them, cucumbers have them. You can look at the calyx, that little stem that's holding the flower, when the flower's out, and see how big the fruit's going to be. If a plant is planning on putting on a small fruit, it'll tell you that by putting on a thin calyx. If it's planning on building big fruit, it'll put a thick calyx. It's telling you exactly what's going on, where it's at, how it's feeling, what its energy level is, if you just stop and pay attention to the details. It's not hard to look and see these things, but you have to stop and look and see these things. What color are the leaves? Green? Well, usually the leaves are green, but what color green? Is it a deep, dark, rich green, or is it like a washed out yellowish green? Is it a shiny leaf green or a dull leaf green? Those kind of nuances are actually very important. What color is the sap? Let me get my... I got my hat already. I use one of these little bridge presses, which is a vice grip with a piece of metal welded on it, but you can use a garlic press. Take a leaf off your tomato plant or whatever the plant is, squish it, get a drop of juice, and look at the juice and for its color and consistency. You would like as dark green as possible to black. Ideally, it's black and slimy. Normally, it's, you know, watery and light green color. So you want to go from a watery, you know, very, very watery consistency and light green, you can see through it, to a black, slimy, you know, mucilaginous almost consistency. The darker the color and the slimier the juice is, the healthier the plant is.
This is all applicable to all green
plants.
Leaves,
right? Yes. Where do I get this? What's it called? I call it a bridge press. This goes with the refractometer. What's that?
You made that bridge press.
I did not make this. It was some farmer up in Maine makes them. And I buy them. He's the guy that hires them to make them. This is, if you join the organization, you get this. You get the refractometer and the bridge press and the chart, the bridge chart, so you can actually test crop quality. So that's why I've got these sheets.
You squeeze the leaf?
When the plant is growing,
yeah.
You want to squish the leaf to see how healthy it is. If you take a leaf off and squish it, you can basically get an idea of how vigorous the plant is. And specifically, because you drop the sap onto the refractometer and look at it, you can get a number. And that's really what you do, is to see how healthy your plants are, is test their Brix readings. If you've got high Brix in the leaf, you know your plants are healthy. If you don't, you know you can do something about it.
Brix is sugar?
Brix is not sugar.
No.
Brix is calibrated to percent sucrose. Let me just explain what Brix is. People have heard about refractometers?
BRIX.
No, refractometer. All right, this is your handy-dandy little gizmo that can... This is the best tool we have now for discerning crop quality, for starters. I'll get my chart. We discussed last time nutrient values in crops and the correlations to health. Yes? Sort of?
Yes.
Conceptually? This is a bridge chart. Poor, average, good, excellent for a number of different crops, vegetables, fruits, etc. So your Brix reading will change depending on the nutrient value of the crop. This is a very good way to test crop quality. So ideally, if you guys get a, you know, a few people down here want to engage in this, you can have little meetups, parties, whatever you want to call them. Go to, like I said before, go to the farmer's market and buy a number of different crops from different farmers and test them and actually be able to tell which farmers are doing a better job growing quality food. If you want to know which farmers' crops taste better, which farmers' crops are actually better for you, this is the best way to do it that we have access to right now.
Are the Brix readings the same in leaves but different across fruit, or does that chart, you know, match like...
That chart is for the edible part of the plant. And so that differs all the time. Leaves across the board, we're looking for 12. You want a Brix reading with 12 in the leaves. Is there a leaf of any sort? Anywhere around here?
This is New York, man. City.
What do you think you are?
I know people like, you people like me make like lots of money bringing leaves in to sell to you guys. It's a good thing. It's just about like a scam, actually. A lot of money you make bringing leaves to sell to you guys. It's ridiculous. You make so much money. There's a lot of people living in the city. Anyway. What's up? I'm trying to. Yes. I guess I'll just use this apple as an example. Philip, it's okay. So, very simply, whatever you're going to be testing, you stick it in here and you squish it. Whether it's the leaf or the edible part. I took too big of a piece here, so I have to keep it from sliding out. There we go. Okay. So I got a drop of juice coming out. See that? All right. Close the slide. Look at it. Oops. Focus. And we've got a 14. Clear line, 14. We're done.
What's happening?
Is
that good?
Mediocre.
So you're looking for 12 minutes?
Oh, okay. Sorry.
The chart is what you want to read for the crops. We've got 4 average, good, excellent.
Is that a piece of apple?
4, 6, average, 10, good.
But a leaf should be 12. Is that what said? A leaf should be 12 for
a leaf should be 12.
And that was an apple.
And that was an apple. And 14 is good, and 18 is excellent. So it's a good apple. You have a hard time finding anything excellent. Period. Anywhere.
So the number on the chart is for the leaf?
No. The number on the chart is for the edible part of the plant.
So like, for example, apple, you have to use the apple like you do.
If you want to get a reading on an apple, you have to test the apple.
Thank you.
So if you're buying something, if you're a consumer and you're buying produce, you want to know which store to go to or which farmer's market stand or which CSA to join. You use the refractometer to test the crops, and you can see generally how good of a job that farmer's doing. If you're growing food yourself, by the time you harvest it, it's too late to make any difference, right? When you harvest it, it's done growing. You can't affect the nutrient value. So you test the leaf while the plant's growing, and your leaf is your report card, right? I mean, if you've got a 12 in your leaves every week, you can go and sit back and do whatever else you want to do because your plants are totally healthy and vigorous. They don't need anything. They're going great. If you've got a 4 or a 6 or an 8, you know you've got an opportunity to improve the vigor of your plant if you want actually high-quality nutrition to come out of the parts you're eating. If you've got a Brix reading of 4 in a week, you should not expect your crop quality to be high. There's a direct correlation between the Brix reading in the leaf as the plant's growing and the nutrient value in the crop that you eat it.
And you do it every week?
I am extremely bad about testing my Brix readings, but some people are actually good about it. So for those people who are left brain, the logical people, the spreadsheet people, if you're a spreadsheet type of person, you like your order and systems and data points, this is a great tool for you. It's really, really valuable. It can really give you, you know, good, precise feedback on where you stand, how things are going. Other people can take a look at the plant and say it's fine, or take a leaf and taste it, or, you know, from their bedroom, connect psychically to the plant and ask it how it's doing. Right? I mean, there's numerous ways to do this, but this Brix reading is a very logical, empirical, safe Western, you know, mode to actually get empirical data.
It's
a good baseline. There's no battery. There's nothing. It's just it's simply, you know, good for 15,000, you know, uses.
How do you clean it? Is there
any
special?
I lick it.
That's it. That's good enough.
Done. You can use water and, you know, cloth and things like that as well. So what is Brix? Who was Brix? Brix was an Austrian chemist, I believe, who won the prize that was put out by the German vintners in the 1820s, 1830s. The German vintners are the guys that make wine, and they wanted to know which grape juice would make vinegar and which grape juice would make, you know, excellent wine. And they didn't know. They would put the grape juice in there in the casks, take it out 20 years later, and this one was vinegar, and that one was grape. Right? That's a waste of 20 years in the cask, in the catacomb. We only got so many casks and so much space. So they want to know which grape juice they should be putting in the casks and which grape juice they should be, you know, dumping or whatever else. So they didn't know how to figure it out. And Rick's, his brother Rick Pride, and Rick figured it out. He said it's the specific gravity of the juice that correlates with the quality of the wine. The heavier the juice, the more stuff in the water, the better it is. Very simple. Specific gravity. Right? Specific gravity of water is one. So the more stuff in it, the bigger the number gets. So if this grape juice's specific gravity is 1.1, this grape juice is 1.2, they would use the 1.2 stuff to make wine out of it. And so that was basically all they figured out. And then they, you know, the same way that we don't know who Richter was, but we know what Richter's scale is, or, you know, centigrade or Fahrenheit or whatever they all were. Celsius and Fahrenheit. Yes. You know, it doesn't really matter who Brix was. What matters is what Brix means. And what Brix is calibrated to, it's basically the amount that light will bend when it passes through a certain solution. So if you put your hand in water, it looks like it bends, right? If you put your hand in the ocean, it'll look like it bends to a slightly different degree. There's more stuff in there, the bend is slightly different. So zero Brix is the amount light will bend when it passes through pure water. One Brix is the amount light will bend when it passes through a 1% sucrose solution. Five Brix is the amount light will bend when it passes through a 5% sucrose solution. So Brix is calibrated to percent sucrose. The calibration is percent sucrose. You can put battery acid on a refractometer and get a reading, which means that it's not testing sugar. And anybody who tells you Brix is testing sugar is wrong. They're simply ignorant. They may mean well, but they don't know what they're talking about. Okay, you take olive oil, take vinegar, take any number of materials that have no sugar in them and put them on a refractometer and you'll get a reading. So you're not testing sugar, you're testing the amount of bend, which correlates to the amount of compounds and nutrients in the sap. Is that clear?
Yes.
Specific? People need to understand.
Density?
What's that?
Measuring the density of something?
What Brix is measuring is the amount the light bends when it passes through the sap.
Right.
And there's a correlation between the minerals and compounds in that sap and that bend. So the more minerals, the more compounds, the more functional nutrition you have, the more the light bends. If you notice, when you pass this around, it's a very clear line. It's a very clear line. It's a bad sign. The clearer the line, the less complex the compounds. You'd like to see a very fuzzy line. So you'd like it to be, you know, white at 10 and blue at 16, but no, there's no way to say where the clear line is. The fuzzier the line, the better the quality.
So when you encounter that fuzzy line, where do you pick a number?
Somewhere in the middle. But you call it a fuzzy line, and you understand that that's a very good sign. So it's got a decent, you know, amount of something in the sap, but it's not complex. Complex compounds. Yeah.
I have two questions. One is, could you have seen a fuzzy line at a 12, or would it have been higher? And you know the story you tell about the organic carrots that you ordered?
Yes.
Did you take a Brix reading on those?
No. No. I think this is a great tool, and I'm absolutely right-brained. I go with the flow.
So first question was, is it possible that, you said this is a straight line.
Clear line, yes.
Would you rather see gradation?
A fuzzy line.
Could you see a fuzzy line at 12, too?
Could you?
Yeah. Is it possible? I mean, I just...
As up from the leaf.
Well, we're looking at the apple here.
Right.
So you said
it's at 14 right now.
Was it 14?
No,
it's a good apple.
It's at 14. But I mean, what he's saying is you're looking for fuzzy rather than clear, but that's a good reading. So if it's, but it's not a great reading for 14.
It's mediocre.
But is there a correlation between fuzziness and
right.
a higher
number.
Level of?
No.
So it could be either or both or neither.
Yeah, either you can have either or both or neither. Exactly.
That's what I want. So you could see a fuzzy line at 8.
You could see a fuzzy line at 8.
That's what.
So would that be better than a clear line at 8?
Possibly.
Right.
That's the question. Is it better to have a lower reading with fuzzy or a higher reading with?
The simple fact is that this is very complex science, and no one's done it yet.
Okay.
And this is one of the things we're pushing for strongly in our organization is to build the coalition necessary to fund the research to actually figure out what nutrition is and and how to figure out what relative nutrition this has versus that. We talked about that last course in our little meter we're working on. This is really important information from my perspective, and no one's doing it. No one's bothering to actually study this stuff. If they are, they aren't telling anybody about it. I've got my ears to the ground for years. I've been talking this up. I've been pitching it. I've been we're like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Well, someone should do that. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, someone should do that.
Well, like if you have a straight line that's a high number, it
yes.
could mean that that sap is very high in one ingredient, which makes that sap thicker. That ingredient could be, you know, some sort of sugar in the plant or something else. But it might mean, or it could be that it's, you're saying that it's dehydrated and it's just, I see, because then it gets thicker too. But it might be lacking, the number gets higher, but it might be lacking in other things. I don't know what they are, plant substances like tannins or something, which would cause it to be fuzzy, but wouldn't necessarily send the number way up.
I mean, this is the best tool we've got right now. It's far from perfect. We don't have anywhere near as much data as we'd like to have, but from a common sense, practical standpoint, it's a very valuable, inexpensive tool that can give you great perspective. So that's what it is. And I'm bringing it up because it's used in growing plants. eBay, you can get them for cheap. If you want to join an organization, you'll get one as a membership. There's a basic membership which is $50 and you don't get one. For $150, you get the kit. Yes.
And where do we get the conductivity meter?
Yes, thank you for asking. Conductivity meter, I get mine from pikeagri.com. They're a nice family company, agri.com. And this one I have here is called a HINA. HI98331. So you can find it anywhere you can find it online, knock yourself out.
What did that run?
I think it's like $85 at this point at Pike Agri, which is one of the better prices around.
What is
Pike Agri? Pike Agri, A-G-R-I. P-I-K-E. AGRI.com.
That's where they are. I'm a
conductivity meter. I recommend it. Good people. Good family business. Yes. Question? No. You're just scratching your nose.
Okay. Oh, no. I wasn't.
All right. What color is the sap? That was my what color is the sap conversation. Okay. What's the spacing between nodes? The spacing between nodes is right the length of the branch between the length of the stem between branches. And you would like the length of the stem between branches to be shorter rather than longer. Like that stocky, big, broad structure, not a long, skinny structure to your plants. So they're squash, cucumbers, tomatoes.
The branch and the stem.
If you've got a stem growing, the question is how regular are the branches? Are they close together or are they spread apart? You'd like them to be close together, not like this. You'd like a closer together structure, a stockier, broader structure as opposed to a leggy structure to your plants.
And as the
distance spreads out, you can see that the plant is getting less and less healthy. You will see this change week to week. All these things morph and modulate continuously. From what you can read the history of the plant. In September, you can go look at a tomato plant, and you can see what it was doing in June, how it felt in July, what it was suffering from a lack of in August. You can read the whole history of the plant in the structure of the leaves if you know how to read these nuances. It's not really that complicated. How many petals are each flower? I always thought, and I was always told, that plants always had a certain number of petals in their flowers. Well, I saw this little thing, I've been told it's called a king flower, tomato. Ever seen a tomato with a big flower, like it's like a sunflower, like layers, rows of petals on it?
What's it called?
Somebody said, oh, that's a king flower. I'm like, well, what's a king flower? I don't know what a king flower is. Just pay attention to details, basically. Just stop and look at your plants. Stop and check in with them. Just pay attention to the nuances. You'll see things that are very elucidating. Stem size, bigger is better. Stem strength, stem should be able to bend between your fingers without breaking, right? Ever walk by your zucchini plants and have them, like, look at them the wrong way and the leaves fall off? You know what I'm talking about? That's not healthy.
They're shy.
They're crashing. They have osteoporosis, and they break their hips when, you know, when they fall down. That's not a good sign. You want your branches and your you know stems to be able to bend, not breathe, not be so brittle. Let's just sort of nuance. Stem hairs, more hairs is better. People know about stem hairs, like tomatoes sometimes they're a little fuzzy. You want fuzzy, right? Furry even you want. Ever had an eggplant with like a thorn in the middle of the leaf? Yeah. You've seen that happen? Yeah. Like the eggplant just busts out this like 2-3 inch thorn in the middle of the leaf. You're like, where did that come from? Most people have never seen it happen before.
What is that?
It's an antenna. I don't know how it works, but it's like, what the hell is it doing? In healthy plants, the healthier the plants, the more 3D they are. The more they have all these little hairs on their leaves and their stems, and the bigger they are, and you know, it's I don't know exactly how it works. It looks, my supposition is it's antenna function. But anyway, there's a correlation between hairiness and vigor and health.
Are there certain kinds of plants that don't have stem hairs, or
yes.
They all have stem hairs? What plants don't have stem hairs?
You can have a hard time finding a stem hair on a brassica family plant. Broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, they're just not going to have. Tomatoes, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You know, it's usually an issue of gradation of the tree. So that's the biggest thing, I guess, is if it's a plant that does have them, does it have a lot? Does it have not very many? You know, that's one more thing to look at. Pay attention to. Okay, solid stems, in general, grain crops and brassica family plants, broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower family, is where you have the biggest issue. And a hollow stem connotes a functional calcium deficiency. You would like to have a round stem as well, not too long. Think about a broccoli plant. Think about the stem on a broccoli. Sometimes they're fairly oval shaped. They should be perfectly circular. Mm. All stems should be perfectly circular, except for like potatoes, you know, they can't be circular, right? So that's irrelevant. But all the rest of the plants, they should have a round stem. It should be round. It should not be oblong or oval shaped. It should be perfectly circular. And if it's not, calcium deficiency. Yes.
So when you buy a head of broccoli in the grocery store, or a lovely organic head of broccoli,
yes.
And it's cut there, and there's like a...
Hold on a minute.
Yeah, that was not good.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Because they always are.
As an organic farmer, I'll say it numerous times. Just because it's organic does not mean it's good.
No, okay.
It may be less toxic than the conventional version,
right.
But it's not necessarily as good for you.
It's just that we're so used to seeing it that I since every head of broccoli I've ever bought,
yes.
I just assumed that was how it was.
Exactly. Yeah. It's exciting how bad things are. opportunities for improvement are massive, right? I mean, it's so easy to do better. It's like this amazing opportunity. Coming in, it's like the bottom of the market, right? And like things would have a hard time getting worse. Get in now, like, I mean, it's only going up. And the average, it's quite exciting. I mean, anyway. All right.
Like your chicken.
What's that?
Like your chicken.
What about
your $50
chicken? $50
chicken.
All
right, that's exciting.
Yeah. I can't believe it. I'm like, it's not.
It's opportunity.
$13 a pound beef, you know, and like, you know, all my fancy cuts of steak. I'm like, $13 a pound? You're gonna pay that for beef? And he's like, I guess people pay more than that. You know, people pay $20 a pound for $45 a pound for their sirloins and their tip, whatever they all are called. Like, I got a bunch of scrub land, you know, some swamp and forest and, you know, otherwise unusable field. Get a couple baby cows, chuck them out there. Let them hang out for, you know, a year and a half. Bring them to the slaughterhouse and you got $3,000. Oh, do that with five cows and you got $15,000. Do that with 300 chickens and you got another $15,000. You know, I mean, putting together a $50,000 income is not hard on 3 or 4 crops if you just are halfway intelligent about it. Strategic, you know, look at the land, what's the opportunities here, find a couple markets, and set them up. I've got $100,000 in orders right now for this year that I can't fulfill. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Can I ask you a question since you mentioned cattle just now?
Yes.
A program I belong to has, you know, different fields. Like I said, some of them it's 6 inches, but this one very large field where it's just 2 or 3 inches of sort of sandy soil that it's just kind of got some grass growing on it. That's about all. And people have tried to clear the rocks, and, you know, it's too much work and nothing much comes of it. And I'd read Abe Collins or seen on the Internet, you know, and he's saying that dairy farmers know that the best way to build soil is by grazing some cattle. Mm-hmm. In a field like that, like 3.5 acres, would you think it's better to just, like you say, throw a few cattle on it for a couple of years and let them tromp in the manure and the, mm-hmm. and the hay and whatever else? Or do you think that it would make sense to try to build up the soil, you know, with composting and cover cropping and things like that?
I wouldn't compost or cover crop. I'd leave the soil. I'd leave the grass growing, but I would certainly add minerals and things to the soil, and which Abe Collins does too. He certainly uses sea minerals and things like that. Ideally, if you're building soil, you're going to be doing rotations. You're going to be bringing the cows through different paddocks mm-hmm. and letting the grass get to a certain height, so they come through and they, you know, eat the top 3 or 4 inches, and then they stomp the rest of it in. Mm-hmm. And that decomposes and builds. That's the way to really build soil. But if you just leave the cows out, if you got 3.5 acres and, you know, 3 cows, they'll keep the whole thing grazed down, and it'll never go through that cycle. So you really want to be rotationally grazing through.
But you might consider using cattle as part of a plan to build up that land. Yeah.
What's that guy's name? Alan Savory? Anybody know Alan Savory?
Yes.
I mean, radical solutions being manifested for decades, taking deserts and turning them into grasslands.
Oh, yeah, the TED Talk, right?
He did.
Did you do a TED Talk just recently?
Alan Savory. He's been around for decades.
Yeah.
Savory. South Africa?
Yeah. He did a little talk about elephants and the bison and, yeah.
Right. I mean, he's like, all these guys are, depending on your location, it's
turning desert.
What's that?
You turn desert into...
Desert into grassland. Exactly. I mean, people who think that, you know, we're running out of resources. I'm sorry. But, like, the planet is totally revitalizable. I mean, we can totally do it. There's no reason to think that we should be afraid of desertification and wearing out of land. And I mean, it's very defeatist. It's ignorant. I mean, we can do this. We can totally take the planet and revitalize it. It's not hard. People are doing it. They're documenting it. They're now with the internet and YouTubes and all that stuff, TED Talks. I mean, if you want to find solutions to our problems, they're there.
What do you do with the rocks? You could have a lot of rocks on the land.
Yeah.
The global land, do we pick them out or we keep them?
Find a different spot to till. I've got 15 acres and one of them is tillable. Because the other 14 aren't fit for being tilled.
No, is it the land? Is rocks in the land?
Yeah. There's too many rocks to till. That means you shouldn't be tilling it. I mean, you can go start pulling rocks out, but they're going to go down a long way before you run out of rock.
So what do you do if you wanted to farm it?
It's a sign of worn out soil.
Right.
There's no soil left. There's no soil. Soil is gone, and you're down to the subsoil, basically. So it's thin, worn out soil. So I wouldn't till. I'd do perennials. I would do, fruit trees, berry bushes, nuts, herbs, you know, flowers, blueberries, raspberries.
Or cattle? Isn't that...
Sure. Cattle. Yeah, animals.
Sure.
After about 1,000 years.
Wait 1,000 years.
Half inch a year. It would take you a decade, but you can certainly build the soil.
Wouldn't you want a lot of biomass to keep cutting it down?
The best way to build biomass is to build root systems, is to have a high Brix leaf. If you've got high Brix in the leaf, that means that plant has lots of extra energy, sugar, carbohydrates, amino acids. And what does it do with that extra energy? It injects it into the soil. Mm-hmm. Into the soil to feed the soil, which grows and dies and turns into organic matter in the soil. So the best way to build soil is to have hybrid foliage, which is injecting sugar and nutrients into the soil to build
garden. So wouldn't you grow a lot of biomass of that kind of plant and then keep cutting it back so that then it'll keep growing? Or is that...
You could cut it back. You could mow it. I mean, you could raise it.
But also leaving the biomass in to decompose there would not be a good idea too.
What's going to be on the surface of the ground is not going to probably integrate very well. It's probably going to oxidize primarily. The real organic matter, to build organic matter, it has to come through the roots. I mean, the most efficient way to build organic matter.
Are you doing both,
then? The roots are injecting carbon into the soil, which is then being turned into stable, permanent carbon. In the perennial situation, there's no tillage involved. You're not turning over the soil. Whatever's going to land on the surface of the soil, maybe some of it will be digested into the soil, but most of it's probably going to be, you know, oxidized and turned into carbon dioxide. You have to look at a specific situation to see how the most well managed. But this guy's got a situation where he's got rocks.
He has maple trees.
What's that?
Maple trees.
Maple trees?
Yeah.
Maple trees would be a great thing to grow in a rocky place in Vermont. Yeah, there's a viable business model there. But taking all the rocks out to grow vegetables, I don't know. I have to look at the land and see. Back to the handouts. Internode points, I talked about this before. Shorter internodes, they'll stock your plant to build higher yields. In tomatoes and vine crops, 4 to 6 inches should be the maximum. And less ideal. Space between branches. General parameters on leaf thickness, thicker is better. A thicker leaf can do more photosynthesis. It's basically a solar panel. It can capture more photons that are coming through, and you know, therefore be more energetic for the entire plant. Iron, magnesium, potassium are correlated with photosynthetic capacity and leaf thickness. So if you do not have thick leaves, one of these three things is probably what you're deficient in. Leaf shape, this is really important. People are probably familiar with the tomato plant, you know, a big, blocky, you know, nice, dark green-looking tomato leaf, you know what that looks like? Nice, tomato leaf. Have you seen on the top of your tomato plants in September these little long, like, long, skinny leaves? Yeah. And you can see that on the bottom of the plant, it's got big, blocky leaves. The top of the plant's got long, skinny leaves, which means that every single leaf in between was some variation going from big and blocky to skinny and small, right? Every single time a new leaf came out and was somewhat less blocky and more skinny, that plant was telling you it was getting weaker and running out of gas. Every single time the new leaf comes out, it tells you what was the mineral availability when this leaf was being built. And you want to see, in general, blockier, larger, broader, blockier shaped leaves. You don't want to see small leaves and skinny leaves. You want to see big and broad. And you can see that happen with squashes, with, you know, cucumbers, with cabbages, with broccoli, you know, through all sorts of different crops. You will see the size and shape of the leaf change through time. Ideally, you do not want to see that happen. Ideally, you want to see the big broad leaf continue through the entire plant. As soon as you see the leaf shape changing, you know something's wrong.
So is that when you put this water in?
Is that when you put the water in? I would just do it personally. I just do it on a weekly basis anyway.
Right, that's what I mean.
If you do it on a weekly basis, you can have a situation where you never see the leaf shape change. But you have to stay proactive on it and ahead of the curve. Is the objective. Yes.
Shouldn't it change somewhat once it starts maturing fruit?
A tomato plant can live for a very long time. In our environmental conditions, you know, it'll get frosted if it stays alive until October or November. In most people's cases, it dies from disease long before it gets frosted. And what happens generally is that when the plant starts to go into its reproductive phase, it starts to, you know, make fruit, fill out fruit, it's like a pregnant woman. Its nutritional demand goes up. If the soil is insufficient, then she starts to tweak out. And she starts to suck all the nutrients she can out of her bones. All the calcium is, you know, gone from that tibia. It's going into the baby. All the potassium is coming out of those bottom leaves. They turn yellow, they turn brown, they fall off. Right? All that symptomology of disease that you get is symptomology of deficiency because you've got a plant who's not getting her needs met. Anybody been pregnant here? Know somebody been pregnant? Yeah, if you've ever been around anybody who's pregnant, you would understand it's very important that they are fed well and regularly. And if you understand that, then think about your plants as pregnant women, because they basically are. They must be well fed or they're going to lose it, right? They're going to crash. And that's what happens. Every year, I've got late blight too. I got early blight. Was it alternate area or something? Who cares what it's called? The name of the disease is irrelevant. What's relevant is that she's starving to death, and you're just letting it, watching it happen. And you think she's got, we'll treat the symptom of Lyme tick. No, you do the symptom. It's a symptom. It's not the cause. You need to deal with the cause. And that's nutrition in these cases. So,
Wait. No, that was actually really helpful.
That was great.
Thank you. Yeah. And when you make the analogy to human beings, it's very helpful.
It's very
true. I think it's totally true. I mean, it's true to life, is what it is. And we are, self-identified, and so we can see it ourselves. But we don't recognize that the same exact thing is going on throughout all the other kingdoms and all the other forms.
No,
the same basic needs are present. So.
My only thing is you asked about water, like during the reproductive phase, right? Is that was that
water? She said no. That they should.
Oh.
They should just change leaves when they come
in.
Oh. You do see a difference. But the nature of the plant is to have a nice big broad blocking leaf, and if it's healthy, it'll stay that way.
Because my only question had to do with water during the reproductive phase. And I don't have tons and tons of years of experience, but I have a few years experience.
Yeah.
I was told that with some plants, it's not good to water them too much or overwater during the fruiting time, because they'll make fruits that are further more prone to fungus and make fruits that are like more watery and less sweet or whatnot.
Because you never overwater, course, absolutely.
Okay.
Certainly, it is a technique of grape growers and tomato growers to dry out their soils when they're filling their fruits, which functionally lowers the water level and increases the sugars and other compounds by dehydrating.
Yeah.
Right?
Right?
So dehydration is not increasing quality.
Right.
That's just dehydrating.
Bringing the fruit.
Right.
Or sweeter, less.
Yeah. There's less water because you've dehydrated the plant.
Yes. Okay.
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense to me.
Except that we would maybe just then get a fruit that was like too watery or too, like, not sweeter.
Well, then you taste how good it actually is. If you're growing mediocre quality food, the more you can dehydrate it, the more the flavors are concentrated.
I see what you're saying. So if it's not great to begin with, then maybe that's a good.
It's a very good way to raise friction. It's to starve your plants for water.
Interesting.
Right. I mean, it's not complicated.
Of course, right. Yeah. More nutrition.
It's very simple.
Yeah. More.
Yeah. So getting back to the bricks, as long as your plant is green and shows no signs of dehydration, then you can trust your brix reading.
Ideally, I like to do a brix reading at 7 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. If you can't get a good conductivity reading, don't bother taking the brix reading. First things first. So if you can get a good conductivity reading, that means you've got sufficient water in the soil. And then you shouldn't have an issue with dehydration. In the middle of a very hot summer day is not the right time to take a brix reading, because the level will be higher. As the leaves dehydrate, you'll get a higher reading. So if you want to get a humbling, this is the worst case scenario of brix reading, you take it at 7 o'clock in the morning, just as the sun's coming up. That's the lowest point in brix reading without the humidity. Okay, leaf density. Plants highly loaded with leaves have a higher productive capacity.
Yes. Oh, just one thing. I've always felt that plants grew better from rainwater.
No question.
Okay. Well, you know why? I've always wondered why.
I've got some thoughts, and I haven't written into the end of this agenda.
Okay.
I'm starting to feel a little bit pressed for time, so.
Okay.
This is great. I love a nice, good-sized group with lots of questions. Things as the season progresses.
Just buy borax in the
borax.
In the grocery
store? Borax.
Okay. Mix it with water.
Mix it with water and a little bit of molasses. And water into your gardens. 30 pounds per acre borax.
30 mule team.
20 mule team. 20 mule team, 30 pounds per acre.
Unless you have dehydrated lots over there?
Yes.
Can you just use the liquid?
I would use liquid molasses. Yeah.
How much water does it matter?
As much as it takes to get the amount of borax you have in solution. If you've got, you know, a half pound of borax, a quart of water is not going to be enough to get it in solution. So you need to use as much water as it takes to get it in solution.
So
30 pounds per acre borax or 15 pounds per acre soluble borax. If you're a farmer, you use soluble borax. If you're a gardener, oftentimes you use borax. Soluble borax is another form of boron. It's got 20% boron instead of 10%, so use half as much. Okay. Stem and leaf strength and ability to flex and bend back and forth are correlated with calcium. So if your plants are brittle, calcium deficiencies. Strong cell walls correlate to fungal resistance with calcium. So if you have fungal disease, you probably have low calcium levels. Or if you have low calcium levels, you're susceptible to fungal disease. If you have good calcium levels, you're not susceptible to get to fungal disease. Roundness of stem is 24. Leaves have a wrinkled appearance. This is a good one. People know green chard, green Swiss chard, Morgan chard. You know, like, or again, early in the year, you'll see big, broad leaves, big, flat, nice, glossy leaves. And sometime around midsummer, they start to get really crinkly, ruffled, you know, savoy. Leaves that have a wrinkled appearance. Maybe fully. When they go from big and broad and flat to wrinkled, that means the plant just ran out of access to calcium.
What's the put?
It depends on whether it ran out of calcium or boron or silicon or what exactly.
What do you put for calcium?
The question is, you know, I mean, ideally you solve the problem systemically in the fall by addressing your deficiencies. A liquid calcium, you can use eggshells and vinegar. If you take eggshells and put them in vinegar, you can get all the calcium out of the eggshells into the water. So you put that, you know, mix that with water and you can have a good, very available calcium source. There's also the different products you can buy. Gypsum is good. Oftentimes it actually is still boron that's causing the calcium deficiency. When the soil dries out, that whole process, the biochemical process, shuts down. So, I mean, really pay attention to water. I mean, so many of your problems will be solved by keeping the soil moist. It's not even funny. I mean, it's really not even funny. And the question is, once you've solved your problems, how far are you going to push it to vitality and vigor? And if you want to push the vitality to vigor, then you have to have this foundational mineralogy and biology going. Let me see. Silicon, I'm just going to skip through a few here. Maybe you can read it later if you want. Vine crops need silicon to become resistant to powdery mildew. Powdery mildew, the little element silicon?
Yeah.
That's the one that takes out your cucumbers and your summer squash and your winter squash every year?
Yeah.
What's that?
Phlox.
And phlox.
Always phlox.
All right. This is a flower. What'd that do? Silicon is necessary for fungal resistance in many cases, specifically for the powdery mildews. Your biggest problem with powdery mildew is going to be the fact that you've got hybrid seed, which has a poorly developed root system capacity, which is going to inhibit its inherent potential to pick up silicon from the soil in the first place. So as long as you're using hybrid seed, you're always going to be somewhat susceptible. But certainly you can supplement with, this is where I said the basalts and the granite is going to put down. Anybody with a horsetail is, you can make a horsetail tea or concoctions. Horsetail is 98% silica or something, it's ridiculous. So horsetail tea or equisita, they call it, in the biodynamic community, very good silica source.
But if you add these things during the season, like you say, oh, the plant is, you know, the leaf, it could take weeks before the the plant starts to absorb them in some cases, couldn't it, or longer or something?
The reason I start the course with soil test and mineral balancing is because if you address these things systemically to start off with, you put yourself in a position to not have to deal with this in the first place.
Sure.
And if you don't do your homework and get the foundations built, you're going to be doing crisis management. It's basic. It's just basic strategy. You need to start with the foundation, and that is, you know, addressing what's not there and putting it in. You can certainly make these teas and you can get yourself to a tea. But you know, the objective is to not have to be a crisis management. The objective is to have healthy plants that are well established, they don't have to worry about. All these crops, right? I mean, summer squash, winter squash, cucumbers, they should go through frost. They should not die. Potatoes, tomatoes, I mean, there's beans, there's no reason they should die. Right? Everybody knows that?
No.
No.
So you mean the
potato
plants will come back?
I mean, potato plants should keep growing until it's too cold for them to live anymore. Mm-hmm. They should never get eaten by anything. They should never get diseased. They should never die in August or whenever they crash, right? Tomato plants, they go along, and then they're dead, right? Winter squash, going along, bam, dead. Mm-hmm. Right? People have this happen to them?
Yes.
Yes. If they're well fed, they will keep going all the way through October.
When it gets too cold,
the cold kills them. Generally, they die because of pests or diseases long before the cold kills them. And there's no reason that they should, except that they're unhealthy. What you should expect from your plants is that they produce well and continuously for months, through October, basically. Down here, in November. I kept potatoes growing in November in my house, 200 miles up here. After an 18-inch snowstorm melted, potato leaves were still green growing. I've had tomato plants get, you know, 26-degree frosts and be flowering the next morning. When they have high Brix readings, it's like they have antifreeze in their sap. Right? They don't. It's not water. It has a lower freezing temperature. So a moderate frost is not going to hurt, is not going to kill your plants. All these crops should be able to grow long into the fall. I mean, not that it matters, but from my perspective, that's a really good season because most people's crops are dead at that point, and the market is wide open for, you know, cucumbers and summer squash in September. No one's got them. It's ridiculous. You got this amazing wide open window of good soil, good air, you know, big strong healthy plants, and everybody else's crops have crashed. Don't push the early season, push the late season.
I did like a late planting, probably too late because my plants got about this big and then got too cold, but now they're in the ground and they're still green. Should I let them grow?
Of what?
Carrots, lettuce, cabbage. So they kind of got stunted, but they're still sitting there.
Green. Right.
Would they be like more deficient since they were cold and then?
The carrots might go to seed.
They're both seed.
I would let the lettuce grow for sure. There's nothing like trying things out, right? Just play with it.
I don't know if it would go anywhere.
Try it out. I mean, do all the stuff, but just leave a couple in the corner and see what they do. If you're worried about them not freezing well, you keep your face really down. Okay, I need to move a little bit faster. Silicon, done. Okay. Boron facilitates carbohydrate transport down to the roots and nutrients up the leaves. Insufficient Brix will boron will form the stagnant Brix reading in crops. Okay. What does that mean? So Brix reading, I didn't show you exactly what you're looking for. I told you 12 was your target.
Well, you said it depends on the crop, on the species.
For leaves,
when you harvest your crop, it's too late to do anything.
No. But we want depends on the species, correct?
No. You want a Brix reading of 12 in the leaf while the plant is growing.
For any
period type.
Okay.
End of story.
Gotcha.
And if you are up at 10 on the lettuce, you should get pretty proud of yourself.
Okay.
And 12 on a tomato is not very hard at all. This is the grand tumbler. I mean, anybody who's cocky and thinks they're a great gardener, you know, get up to your fractometer and go test their leaves. It's, I mean, It is a wonderful way to humble yourself. Because your plants are never doing anywhere near as well as you think they might have been doing. And then you have to look at these things and start to get the pressure when you go up. And you see them kick into, you know, turbo gear. And they just like, they get big and strong and they grow and they produce like, oh my God, I never thought. I mean, would anybody ever consider picking a bushel of peppers off of one plant at once? Like, I'm going to bring my bushel basket to the pepper plant and pick all the peppers off this one plant, and it will fill this bushel. How much is it? That bushel is like 9 gallons. I think it's like 35 liters.
Have you seen that? You've done that?
I've seen pepper plants that big. They could have had that many peppers picked off of them. Yes. 7 foot tall eggplants. I mean, these things are not impossible. They're very doable. But you have to have the conceptual opportunity. It's not going to happen if you don't have hydrogen, right? It's not going to happen if you don't have good soil conductivity. So if you can stay on top of those two bases and monitor them, and if they're not where you want them to be, work on it. You can go a long way in 1 year. But you know, these are things to pay attention to and manage. So what the point I want to make here about bricks is this is 7 a.m. and this is 2 p.m. So this is a daily cycle. Your bricks reading goes up and down on a daily basis. And the question is the bottom point the same spot or is it going up? And this model here is going up. That's what you want to see. So you take your test, you know, 1 week here, and the next week you're over here, and you're a point and a half higher, you're in good shape, making good progress. This is what it should look like. If it doesn't, if you see a bricks line looks like this at 7 a.m., 2 p.m., 7 a.m., 2 p.m., that means you've got a boron deficiency. If your bricks does not move up and down during the day, you've got a boron deficiency. If you ever think you might have a boron deficiency, this is how you test it. Insufficient boron will correlate to a stagnant brick reading in crops that does not fluctuate during the day. That's what I said. That's what it means. Adequate levels of calcium in the soil at the bottom of the plant and on the top of the plant will also correlate to a boron deficiency. So, if we know we've got big, broad leaves at the bottom of the plant, we've got good calcium levels in the soil, and we've got little small leaves on top, we know we've got good calcium in the plant, at the bottom, we know there's good calcium in the soil, it's contaminated to the top of the plant. That's a calcium deficiency, but it's really a boron deficiency. It's the boron which is inhibiting, or the lack of boron is keeping the calcium from moving to the end of the plant. So when you see those leaves getting smaller and smaller and smaller, you can be very suspicious if you've got a boron deficiency. Does that make sense logically? Take my word for it. All right. Sulfur. Old leaves turn yellow and don't drop. This is a classic. I think of broccoli or cabbage or Brussels sprouts. You ever see those yellow leaves in the bottom of Brussels sprouts?
Yes.
Kale plants, like turn yellow and hang out, don't do anything?
Yes.
Sulfur. Classic sulfur deficiency. See that happen on a plant? You have sulfur deficiency. Phosphorus and nitrogen, I don't have much to say about. Basically you got your dull bluish green, you got your yellow or purple. Potassium is, I have a lot to say about. Potassium is a transport element and catalyst for plant sizing. It will not itch. If plants aren't filling out there, if your fruit's not filling out, if your plants aren't sizing up nicely, it's probably a potassium deficiency. Think about the structure, the shape of the classic shape of a red delicious apple. It's full on top and pinched on the bottom. That's a symptom of, that's like a classic potassium deficiency symptom. So when your cucumbers get pinched on the bottom, you ever had that happen? When your summer squash doesn't fill out at the bottom? When your tomatoes get smaller and smaller and smaller? Right, you start out, your first tomatoes are like 12-ounce tomatoes, and the second ones are 10-ounce, and the third ones are 8-ounce. By the end of the season, your tomatoes are like 4 ounces. When they were 3 times bigger at the beginning of the year. That lack of sizing, that getting smaller and smaller and smaller, again, potassium. Generally, potassium and calcium are two major issues. Potassium is because your soil dries out, calcium because you don't have enough boron. But your two major macro minerals issues are generally those two that usually would work. Thin stems, thin canvases, thin leaves, small fruit, that's in shortage. That's in shortage. The vine crop looks like a white or yellow band around the outside of the leaf. Ever seen a little yellow band around the outside of the cucumber leaf? A little yellow band? That's potassium deficiency.
Has everyone else known it?
I'm like, I'm not.
Yeah. There's so much opportunity for improvement. I'm telling you, when your plants get healthier, yeah, we all thought we were good. We all think they're pretty cool. Until we get down to brass tacks, we look actually going up. So
we gotta go.
I don't want to hear any more about this.
Get them out of here.
My self-esteem is still at this point.
Yeah,
I'll let it's used in producing chlorophyll, and it's hot weather. It helps cause the plant leaf to turn that nice dark green in the sap, and that dark green. So squishing the sap, look at the color. You know, if it's not that dark color, if you think maybe you've got a magnesium deficiency, or you don't know, if you squish that leaf and you don't get the right color, probably need more magnesium.
So can we supplement magnesium chloride?
Magnesium sulfate is probably better. Epsom salt, a little more Epsom salt. Burn bottom. Magnesium sulfate. Cobalt, poor lead, you mentioned fixation, low bacterial activity. I got all this things written down here. So, peruse them at your leisure.
Low bacterial activity, how are you measuring that bacterial activity? What's the measurement say about that?
What's the measurement of bacterial activity? Well, you can use a CO2 respiration. And there's what's called the Solvita test kit if you want to be specific about it. Generally, I mean, the biggest issue with cobalt is that it is required for most of soil life to exist. And if you don't have cobalt, life, they're B12 dependent. Cobalt is the center of B12. If you don't have cobalt, you don't have B12, you don't have soil. Everybody, you know, they compost and they cover crop and they mulch and do all the stuff to build soil life, but if you don't have the critical minerals at the core of the enzymes necessary for them to exist, all the compost in the world is not going to build your high levels of soil life.
So what's the name of your customers?
Solvita, S-O-L-V-I-T-A. Solvita test kit. There's more expensive ones you can do to actually, you know, determine what exactly the specifics family members already have. Those are significantly more expensive. Okay. Enough about these minerals. You guys can review this later. And just keep them in here. We're not going to finish class. So, phases of nutritional need. First phase, up to the first blossoming. Basically, after you put that plant into the soil, whether it's a seedling or a seed, up until it hits puberty. Right? So it's growing slowly for the first 3-4 weeks. You know that happens? The plants, they get established, start to build their body, and all of a sudden they kick into overdrive and start to really build their body. Yes? Yes, sort of. Okay, so those, can we call that period between when you transplant and when they start to flower and build their cell body, call that age 5 to age 12? Right? Kindergarten through 6th grade. And then when they start to actually build their body, we'll call that, you know, puberty. They start to build their adult bones and be reproductively viable. Right? You're 12 years old, you can have babies. Okay. You still don't have an adult body yet, but you're reproductively viable. So the first stage in the plant, up to the first blossoming, at that first stage, what you really want to be seeing functioning is the soil life. And I don't bother testing soil life. I will test the Brix level and the water level of the soil. If I have a high Brix reading in the plant, that means that there's enough sugar and other extra energy being produced in the plant that it's injecting a lot of it into the soil. And as long as the soil is moist and it's got sugar coming into the plant, I feel comfortable, because I've done all my other stuff, that I'm going to have a good, well-established functioning microbial system in the soil.
And by water in the soil, you really mean the conductivity?
No, I mean, if I can stick my hand in the soil and I pick up a handful of it and it feels like it's moist, I'm good. If you have a high Brix reading in the plant, that means it's making a lot of sugar energy, which is the food stuff for the soil life. If you don't have the, if you've got a low Brix reading in your leaf, that means there's no food for your soil. Does that make sense? So you, early on in the plant's life, you want to do everything you can to make sure that the soil life is being established well and being fed well. And these are two things you can do to monitor that and check that. And then as the plant begins to go through its reproduction phase, etc., your nutritional demands become much higher. Your actual pulling of minerals out of the soil, calcium and potassium and, you know, all the other stuff, that's when it starts to get really pulled out, is when it's building its adult body and then starting to fill through. That's basically what I've got written down here. Bottom page 7, rooftop balance. Stocky plants are the objective. We talked about that already. You basically want to have these two things in balance. The only time I would recommend pruning your plants is when they start to go leggy. When you start to have that internode spacing get broad, that means that the top growth is getting ahead of the bottom growth. And that's when you want to cut my plants back to get them back into balance. I probably want to trim the tops of the plants, and I also want to make sure my soil is wet across the board. Because probably that's not going to happen once the soil is dried out in the first place.
So you just trim it down to where it looks healthy?
No, I just take a couple, you know, it's the new growth tip that is producing these growth hormones. Even 2 or 3 inches down from the new growth tip, they're not being produced. But what happens is it gets hormone imbalance, and it screws the whole plant up. So the growing root tip produces growth hormones, the growing leaf tip produces growth hormones, and they keep each other in check. It's like a dynamic balance in the soil. And if the soil system dries out and the roots stop growing, the roots growth hormones stop being produced, the top growth hormones are still being produced, they suppress the root growth hormones, and the roots start to senesce, and start to die back, and then it's a death spiral. So when you see that spreading out, accentuated growth at the top, that means your plant is in that stage. And one thing you can do to address it is to trim off the top, the new growth tips. Cut it back a little bit, give it a trim. It's overextended itself. It can't sustainably be as big as you have to cut it back. All right. How does it turn out? We write up for positivity and bricks are on this page here. So, page 8. Conductivity corresponds to electrical energy flow in the soil. For a minimum of 200 in the spring, 600 to 800 in the fruit fill. Let me just amend those numbers slightly or give you some perspective. I said 150 is a good baseline of the soil when you're planting it, and I'll stick to that. 200 is great, but you don't need it. I said you want to have this kind of a curve going through the year, your soil conductivity. The question is, what's this peak? Is it 800 or is it 250? And if you have a low organic matter soil, like 2% or 3% organic matter, you probably need it to be at 800. But if you've got a high organic matter soil, like 10%, 250 is probably enough. The higher your organic matter, the greater the buffer capacity, the more minerals are held in the solution, and the number doesn't get that high. Does that make sense?
Slow down, say that again.
Good. I'm happy to repeat myself 2 more times.
Okay.
But you have to say that I didn't get it.
Okay.
Thank you. That the higher your organic matter in your soil, the more buffering capacity it has. The more of the ions are going to be held bound by the organic matter, and the less you're going to see them on the conductivity meter. So if you have a high organic matter soil, something above 8%, 9%, 10%, or greater, a soil conductivity reading of 250 at, you know, in high season, maybe enough. If you have a very sandy or silty or low organic matter soil,
you better have a high around 600 or 800 when your plants are filling with fruit, because that's what you see. What you see is what you've got. It's your organic matter serves like a battery, basically. It gives you it's like a, and so your numbers need to be relatively much lower. You got higher organic matter. So
is it bad to have? Is there a case where it's too much organic matter? Like I know there's an ideal somewhere around 8 or something.
I think 8's good, a good target. 5 to 10 is a good range.
You know, a lot. If you have more than 10, is that a problem?
Not a problem necessarily. I look at the other mills and see where they're at. I mean, basically, if you've got a compost, if you're growing a compost, you've got plenty of organic matter, but you don't have anything else. You don't have a basic mineral in your soil. So that would be the bigger issue. It's not necessarily exactly how high your organic matter is, but what is that symptomatic of? The higher organic matter, the bigger symptomatic of other imbalances and deficiencies. So I would say if you've got plenty of organic matter, you should stop focusing on that and let it be for a while and start focusing on other things that are in real issues. So it would just be something you can turn attention away from.
Is that percent?
Percent. 8%. Organic matter, yes.
Is that measurable? How do you measure that if you have a sample of soil?
It comes out of the readings.
Okay.
Soil test checks it. Soil organic matter. pH, organic matter, exchange capacity. It's on the Logan test.
Oh.
Okay.
How do you know how much organic matter in soil?
Soil test. Take a soil test. Just take a soil test once a year. It tells you what your foundation is. Okay. So that's basically what you need to know on conductivity. And anybody, any questions on it? If you manage conductivity, if you can keep your conductivity up and going like this, you'll be stupefied at how well your plants grow. It's dramatic, the effect the conductivity management can have on crop vigor.
In a higher organic soil, if you're getting into the higher conductivities, is that of any danger of that?
If you're going to get up to 800 microsiemen or millisiemen in a 10% organic matter soil, you have to be jumping all up the salt. There's no way it's going to happen naturally. It's not going to happen. All right. Bricks, sorting the deficiency bricks. Ideally, bricks readings in plant based staff should not drop below 12. Early morning testing is best to show minimum level, said it before, 7 a.m. If 12 is not attained by mid-afternoon of a sunny day, the plant is definitely stressed. If your plant bricks reading is not 12 by mid-afternoon, it needs help. That it is telling you that you can help it out. Need more help. It's weak. It's not feeling vigorous. I don't care how green you think it is, how well you think you've treated it. If it does not have a brick ring of 12 by mid-afternoon, it is not as healthy as it could be. Regular weekly monitoring. Same point in the plant is necessary for significant reading. It's an important point. Don't take a brick ring from the top of the plant 1 week and the bottom of the plant the next week. Take a brick ring from the same part of the plant every week. Ideally, the newest fully formed leaf. Whatever the newest fully formed leaf is, pull that one off that week and test it. And then you'll see where's the plant at right now. That's telling you what's in the solution, what it's building itself up, how it's doing. Make sense?
So you have to wait basically 1 week after to see the result of the supplement.
No. You should be able if you identify what you think is a deficiency and you feed the plant in a foliar spray, you should be able to see a response within 2 hours. If you do not see a 1 or 2 point increase in bricks within 2 hours of applying foliar spray, that would be what the plant wanted.
Oh, you spray on the leaves, not spray on the leaves.
If you don't have enough conductivity, you need to do something about the soil.
Mm-hmm.
If your conductivity is good, then you can deal with bricks and foliage.
So you only spray the leaves. They're deficient.
My general process is to not bother with all these meters and measurements and numbers and just feed my plants every week and not worry about it.
No, I'm just saying.
But
in case. In principle,
if you're
you find a problem in the soil, the conductivity, put something into the soil. Until you have good conductivity, you kind of don't need to worry about the leaks, the bricks. If your conductivity is not good, you'll never have a good brick feeding, unless you dehydrate the plant. So bricks comes after conductivity in order of priority. Once the conductivity is there, the plant's growing well, then you can focus on the nuances of getting it to be, you know, grow better. Does that make sense?
I have a number. Can I get the number higher?
The bricks
because you say, yeah, the brick reading can be low, like it was below 12, and conductivity still be good?
Yes.
Can the number be 12, lower than 12?
If your conductivity is good, basically, this is the order of priority. First thing you check is conductivity. If it's not sufficient, you need to do something about that soil. Put something into that soil, you know, help it do better. So if it's early in the plant's life, and I'm not seeing a good bricks reading, and I'm not seeing a good conductivity reading, I would like molasses or sugar, some enzymes, some inoculants. I would water in some life into that soil with some life food to kickstart that conductivity process. Right? I mean, you can add salt to the soil and get the conductivity to go up, but that's not going to systemically solve your problem. If your soil conductivity is coming from the soil life digesting the soil and making it available, then you see that's not happening early in the plant's life, how do you stimulate that? You put some soil life food and some soil life into that environment. Re-inoculate it. Try to stimulate that soil life. Yes.
One more 5-minute break.
Shortly.
I'm getting a bit.
It's getting to be about 85 degrees in here.
Yeah, I got the windows open. That's why I take a 1 to 5-minute break, and then you can.
Can I finish this section?
Yeah.
And stop before we have a session. We're almost there.
Right.
Another 5 or 10 minutes of pushing, and we'll get there. All right. Is this a little bit too much for people, the conductivity and the bricks, or you basically feel like starting next?
Yeah.
A few more repetitions, and then maybe we'll think through.
Soil first, then leaves.
Soil first, then leaves.
Okay, that's
nice. Conductivity,
good.
Conductivity, then yes. And, you know, and play around with stuff. You know, this didn't work, let me try that. Get in there, try stuff. Okay. pH, troubleshooting, pH, you can do plant sap pH, that's after bricks, and most people probably are not going to get the whole sophistication this year, so I won't bother you with it. Not only that, but the meter costs at least $250, so that's a sort of game changer right there. If you're a farmer, you've got like an acre of a valuable crop, and you want to monitor it well, you can make $3,000 if you take good care of it. This is, it becomes well worth your interest. Really starting to drill down on what exactly is going on. But in most cases, I think people in this room don't have an issue. So we'll leave it be. In general, let's go to plant for framing and fruiting, middle of page 9. A plant will start generally seriously building its frame 4 to 6 weeks after being transplanted. Therefore, taking a soil test 3 to 4 weeks after transplant, or 1 to 2 weeks before the framing and fruiting time, gives you the window you need to address deficiencies as that plant is about to go through puberty. Does that make sense? If you know the plant is going to start growing vigorously in 2 weeks, you take a soil test right now, different kind of soil test we had before, a week after the soil test, and says what's available. Send it off to the lab, get your report back. And you can feed the plant. You can identify what the plant is not getting and provide it before it starts to go into gear and starts building its adult body. You want that adult body to have strong bones, right? Yes? You want to make sure that when that plant is in the process of building its adult body, it has a full spectrum of nutrition. Because shortly after it builds its adult body, it's going to get pregnant. And if she's going to be a productive, healthy, energetic mother, she must have good, strong bones, right? Are you okay with that? Probably most of you are going to deal with this. It's called the saturated paste test. On the form I gave you, it was the second box. It's a great tool. It's very interesting and good information, but you cannot mix the soil from your tomatoes and your cucumbers and your carrots together for a saturated paste test because something's going on differently in the tomato soil than the carrot soil and the cucumber soil. So you can't mix them all up and send in a sample and get back a representative reading. That makes sense? Every sample has to be for an individual crop, which means it could be very expensive, which means it's probably not going to be.
Is that the taste test the same thing as the weak acid test?
Yes.
You said you're just broadcasting all of the vegetables in one place, though, so if they're not in rows, would it matter?
I'm broadcasting all my salad greens in this bed and all my carrots in that bed.
Okay.
There's certain varieties of vegetables I broadcast the seed, and other vegetables I transplant.
Oh, yeah, I was imagining all the carrots and lettuce in the same place.
No.
Oh.
I love that. So it'd be a pain in the butt to come with a pair of scissors and cut down all the salad greens without cutting the carrots. Logistically.
Didn't you say you need more work in between your tomatoes?
In between my tomato plants, if I've got one tomato plant every 10 feet in a 4-foot wide bed, then I got plenty of space to put in one pepper plant and one eggplant, which is different. So if I wanted to take a soil sample from that area where those are all growing together, that will be a representative area. If I've got a tomato area over here, all tomatoes, and a cucumber area over there, all cucumbers, and a carrot area over there, all carrots, and I take those samples and mix them up, they're going to have different things going on. And wherever I'm going to see in the report, it's not going to be true for anything. Depends on how specific you want to get. It's another tool in your toolbox. Some of these tools I strongly recommend, like the conductivity meter, the spectrometer. Some of the tools I don't strongly recommend, like the taste test, the pH meter. They're there if you want, if you're curious, but I think for most people here, not necessary, at least for the first couple of years. You got enough on your plate getting your other things going. These are like, high-end advanced. You don't need to worry about that. You want to put the basis in place. Whatever it's worth, bottom page 9, half page 10, I've got the metrics of what you should be looking for on hydrated case test. All right, so after all that discussion about tools and technology, I could go back to what I said I do, which is none of it. Because it's way too complicated for me. And I just feed my plants regularly. So there's different ways to go about this. If you're getting, anxious thinking about spreadsheets and numbers and weekly monitorings and all that kind of stuff, if that does not excite you, don't do it. Right? You're not going to do any of this. So come up with an alternate management consistent strategy. If those numbers and things get you excited and it'll be really fun for you to do, that's awesome. Follow that track. For me, the alternate management practice is a regular vitamin supplement, as I've been saying in the past. So for what it's worth, here are some basic components you'd like to have in that. These next three slides here on page 10, regular application guidelines and continuing deviations from the mean by crop. These are some basic quantities and things you'd like to make sure you have. In drip would be into the soil, and as a foliar would be on the new surface. Deviations from the mean by crop. Certain crops at certain times are going to need more of this or less of that. So there they are written out for you. Yes?
It says sea minerals concentrated one part per acre.
Is it one pint?
One by one pint.
So you just said, so foliar, I guess I don't know, with, like you have drip, which is the drench.
Drip is into the soil.
Okay, that's
and so foliar is under the foliage. Foliar spray over the foliage. And does everybody know that you should never do a foliar spray when it's sunny out? When the birds are singing, if you understand what the birds are singing principle, which is, dawn and dusk. If you're going to spray your plant leaves, do not do it in the middle of the sun because you could very easily burn them. Whatever you're spraying onto the leaf, the water will evaporate rapidly, and it may, whatever's left on the leaf may burn the leaf. If you put a foliar spray on at dusk when the dew is setting, then it'll be sitting there all night long, and the plant will have plenty of time to take it into its leaf before the leaf dries out in the morning.
Even the water itself will just act like a magnifying glass, and moisture will burn with the sun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't do foliar sprays during the day. Like when the birds are singing, dawn or dusk is when you do a foliar spray. They're very powerful, very valuable. They can be powerful good, powerful bad.
Younger side as well.
I don't bother getting so complicated about it. I just sort of, I've got this little thing called a mist blower. You ever seen a mist blower before? You know what a leaf blower looks like?
Yeah.
You know what a leaf blower looks like?
Yeah.
I was up in Vermont. I don't know what a leaf blower looks like.
How classy is it, actually?
Yeah. Anyway, we figured it out. Somebody's seen one we talked about, and they figured out what it was. Okay. Anyway, so a leaf blower with a tank on top is what I've got. It's like, you know, a leaf blower's got an engine, cold start. It's got a 4-gallon tank above that, a little pipe that goes down to the end of the leaf blower. Remember the air would come out of the leaf blower? The water drops in to that air and blow. And so the mist blower, I can hit all of you guys, I can hit this entire room with this blower here. I'm just walking along, doing that back wall, right? And so that's what I do, is just do a quick, you know, mist. And just let it settle, let the other leaves. If I was to get out there, I'd pull some personal and pull the leaves off. You know, that's good power. So basically, you want like a fog or a mist that'll just sort of settle on the leaves. If you do so much that water is running off the leaf, you're no longer doing a foliage spray, right? You're doing a drench. So, and you can spray as much as it takes for the water to start to, turn into droplets and roll off. As soon as it turns into droplets and rolls off, you've done too much.
A nice solution that works for a farmer, but is there something smaller scale that you can
Paint sprayer? You can get paint sprayers for like $20. You know, those little plug-in paint sprayers. You got like a 3-quarter gallon tank on them. And they don't spray very far, but they got a really nice mist function. Yeah. You have to pull a cord along behind them, so you got a battery out there. A paint sprayer. Okay, biological process. This is just a reminder. We talked about this last time. But basically, the plant goes through these processes of compounds, starts off with sugar, and gets more complex from there. So after sugar, complete carbohydrates are created. From complete carbohydrates, proteins. From proteins, fats, oils, and lipids. And then finally, the antioxidants, secondary metabolites. Those things can make the plant taste and smell good. And each level of complex and compounds, you have another layer of resistance to pest and disease, especially the insect and fungi and bacterial variety. So the farther along you get, the more pest and disease resistance you get, the better your flavor is, the better it is for you. I generally say, if my plant is susceptible to pests or diseases, if bugs can eat it, or fungi can eat it, or bacteria can eat it, it's not fit for me to eat. Period. If there's diseases or insects eating my plants, that's nature saying, this is garbage. I've sent in my garbage crew to clean them out. They're not fit for you to eat.
So what do we do? Feed the plant? Feed the human? Or fix the soil?
I would feed the plant if you want to keep it alive, or else just, you know, let it die. Personally, if I see insects on any of my plants, I'm like, all right, I'm not going to sell them. I'm not going to pick them. They're not fit. Doesn't happen very often. In certain cases, like what was it? I tried to get my tomatoes to get late blight. I got it and I cured it, but I was doing it on purpose to try to cure it. I don't feel strongly.
You saw these plants, like fruit.
I'm talking about if I've got blight in my tomato patch, if I've got potato bugs in my tomato patch, if I've got powdery mildew in my cucumber patch, if I've got any, you know, like infestation of some pest or some disease. That is, from my perspective, basically way of saying you fail. Do not harvest and consume this plant. This is not fit for consumption.
And would you put that on compost? Would you use that in compost? Or would you put it in
Or you could treat it and cure the disease.
And then it can go away from the same plant.
Yeah, absolutely. You can, I mean, people know about this late plant. So, you got to give your, I mean, just because the plant has disease does not mean, has to die. If you build a community, it'll can develop resistance. So, but the point here basically is, when you see this kind of symptomology of disease, you know that the nutritional quality is poor. And this can be, you know, verified with the product of the process.
What's the formula? Eating apples. Does it say apple is good biologically?
What's that?
It forms by eating apples.
Worms. If worms have a much simpler digestive tract than you. If I was to put a bale of hay here on the floor, someone might sit on it, no one's going to eat it. Walk a cow in here, she's going to eat it. Because it's food for her. Because she's got a more sophisticated gut than you do. She's got four stomachs that can break down cellulose. You can break down protein in your stomach, and a worm can't. So if your apple has protein in it, which it should, on its way to building, you know, secondary metabolites, it'll be indigestible for the worm.
So if worm eats it,
if worms are eating your crops, that's nature's way of saying they're not fit for animal food. They're insect food. They're not animal food. And as the plants get healthier, they become indigestible to these, you know, less evolved life forms, and they become appropriately digestible, they become more flavorful for us. You'll find a direct correlation between bitter carrots that don't taste good and worms in the carrots and low nutrient levels. A tasty, sweet, delicious carrot is not going to have any worms in it, and it's going to have a high nutrient level. Your tongue will tell you what's good for you. It's called antioxidants, phytonutrients, you know, secondary metabolites. We've got fancy names for tastes good. And we have a scientific explanation for what goes on, how that works. So there's a direct correlation between the process of complexing of compounds and pest and disease resistance and improved nutrition. I'm just trying to reinforce that connection, how this is all totally, you know, interrelated. At any rate, what time do we have?
3:20.
5 minutes, 28. 3:35, 7 minutes, stretch and beat. Should we have a good solid hour to try to get this last few pages in? And it's a much more sophisticated system than really understand. We have some pointers, we have enough dots to begin to connect lines to begin to see a shape of what may be going on, but it's a really very sophisticated living system.
You stay all day.
My perspective, the concept of the soil life at the gut of a plant is a really powerful metaphor, and one that we should, you know, do well to understand. People are starting to finally hear about this thing called the human microbiome. You know about the human microbiome?
Yeah.
They basically said that the biology in your gut and the bacteria in your armpits and various other parts of your body, have a powerful effect on your health, your vigor, your vitality, your genetic expression. All these things are affected by the light in and on your body. That your DNA is nice, and it's responds to the biological community you're in, basically, and it expresses itself based on that. This is something that's just starting to come out. For people who are up on that, that's the metaphor applies directly, the corollary there for our plants. But it's a biological system, it's a living system, it's not an abiotic chemistry system, it's a biological system. That's the most important point I want to make on this slide. Hopefully you're all down that rabbit hole, which is wonderful. Understand that central component. From the perspective of chemistry, I just want to, understand a few things. We understand that every mineral has, every element has an atomic radius, has a bonding geometry, a layer of orbitals. Every mineral, every element has a certain size and shape, basically. Whether it's 2 angstroms or 2.6 angstroms as a size, whether it's an icosahedron, dodecahedral, or whatever the bonding geometry is, you have different sizes and different shapes that are basically the definition of these different minerals. And they're the core of these like building blocks. And so to get a certain shape enzyme that is used to do a certain job because of its shape, you need to have a certain shape at the center of that compound. Does that make sense? And a certain size and shape of each mineral is what makes that critical for that enzyme to exist. If you you don't have a certain size and shape at the center of the compound, then your enzyme won't have the size and shape it needs to have, which is why we need all these different minerals or elements in our bodies, in our soil, is because they are the core of all the different enzymes that are used to build and deconstruct all of our living systems functionally. I'm not sure if I said that well or not, but I think it's a basic point to convey. From a perspective of physics, we understand that matter is not really matter, but it's really vibration, or at least it has a very strong component of vibration. And for me, the metaphor that I like to think about is one of music. I did a lot of music when I was younger, and you know, that's a very comfortable language for me. People have been to a fourth grade band concert or an elementary band concert, and you know what dissonance sounds like. Right? And they may or may not be playing with their heart, but it's, yes. But we know what dissonance sounds like, right? And you've also been to a beautiful acapella choir or a string quartet or something that, or even an orchestra that's really beautifully, perfectly in tune. You have all the different notes of the chord all held together. Has anybody ever heard overtones? You know what overtones are? Because when a choir is perfectly in tune, you'll hear a note, an octave up that no one's singing, but because everyone's in tune, it appears. You know about that? Overtones?
Is it harmonics or overtones?
Harmonics? The same thing. Yeah. Harmonics. When you have attunement, you basically have this, you set up these sine waves where the next octave comes, comes into existence. Functional blood is what occurs. For me, that metaphor about our bodies is important. If we can take this understanding that every mineral has a vibration, and when we're eating poorly, we're like that fourth grade band concert. We don't have the right minerals in our bodies, and we're vibrating out of tune. We're dissonant. Our characters are dissonant. Our energy is dissonant. Our body shape is dissonant. We're basically out of tune. Does that make sense to anybody? Sort of a basic level? Not that I'm a Christian, but I think Jesus said that the body is a temple. Anybody hear that? The body is a temple? The body is a temple. What's a temple? The temple is a place where you experience the Lord. Right? Your body, your physical vehicle, your physical body is your instrument by which you experience love and consciousness and all those things. I would suggest, and maybe I'm just making a suggestion here, that if your physical instrument, if your body is in tune, then you're able to experience the overtones, the harmonics of higher consciousness. Does that seem plausible to anyone?
Yes.
Just proceeding in that direction, that's part of my basic incentive and rationale and motivation behind this work. Is I have had the blessing of experiencing a high state of consciousness at one point in time, and I want it again. And I'm doing my best to get back to that state. And I figured out that having a healthy body is a major piece of that puzzle. I can meditate and things like that, but I can't hold the frequency of high consciousness because my body is out of tune. Does that make sense?
Does eating meat have anything to do with it?
I don't know if meat has anything to do with it. I haven't kicked out meat, but I have been much more picky about what meat and what vegetables. So basically, I try to go most of my own food, most of the food that I eat, because I feel like whatever else I can purchase is usually not anywhere near as good from a nutritional standpoint. But I feel like my energy, my vitality, my functional capacity, all these things, I feel like I'm increasing as I begin to eat more and more well. It may be a coincidence.
When did you experience the high state of consciousness, and was it related to what you were eating?
I was living in an ashram in the Himalayas, about to go visit a site where an enlightened person had passed on the lineage. It was the night before of a. It was a very mystical sort of environment.
What food you were eating?
I don't think so. No, I think it was related to other forces at work. Grace. And what about grace? Every now and then, grace, you granted a grace, undeserved, you've been trying hard here. We'll give you, we'll throw you a bone kind of thing. What's that?
No pharmacology
involved? No pharmacology. No, I'm I'm saying I will have missed my entire life, but I, so thus far I've really missed out on a few of those normal experiences. Sex and drugs. Like under, I'm under under experience. Whole city lifestyle, you know, you sort of really have access to things that country bumpkins don't necessarily get access to. Anyway. Perhaps for the better. Okay, physics, vibration, you know, coherence, if all those sort of terms make sense to you or resonate. Quantum mechanics, you know, they say that quantum mechanics is the excuse for anybody to say whatever they want and justify it. So, well, quantum mechanics says, when you go on and make your point, it's really just your point. My understanding is that we understand that something like 95% of the universe is on a frequency range we can't find. People heard about that?
Mm-hmm.
Dark matter, dark energy. We know it's there. It's most of what is, and we can't find it. Heard about that? Somebody heard about that? We can't find 95% of what's there, right? We can't find it. All of our fancy machinery, all the tools, the technology, you know, very deep microscopes, very big telescopes, can't find most of reality.
They did find it. They found the Higgs boson like 2 weeks ago.
The Higgs boson facilitates the mass.
But isn't that what we're talking about, the energy?
There's dark matter and dark energy seem to have an effect. When light passes through them, you know, there's a gravitational effect. We can see that there's something out there that is having an effect on the monitor, light and matter. But we can't find it. There's something out there. We call it, it's called dark matter, dark energy. We can't find it. We don't know where it is. But it seems to be by volume, by weight, by mass, about 95% of the universe. The stuff we can see, the stars and the light and the, you know, galaxies and all that stuff, is about 5% of the weight of the universe. The rest of it is somewhere we can't find. And I propose that perhaps about a different frequency range.
It's right here.
A different octave. What's that?
Right here. We can't see.
Exactly. They say there's enough energy in a cubic centimeter to boil the world's oceans. There's enough energy in the field, you know, the whatever it is, the tensor field, different names for it. There's tons of zero-point field. Exactly. There's lots of people have different names for it, but there's infinite amounts of energy in the universe. Is on a frequency range we can't access with our physical tools. Doesn't mean we can't access it. Right? I would suggest we have the functional capacity in our natures to access those things if we're in tune. And that's really hopefully where this is all going. Again, why I'm not afraid of running out of energy.
You don't have to keep looking at me. I'm not the only one in that room. We'll get you in that room when
you're a proponent of that.
But that is not it. This is not the forum for you and I.
We don't need to be afraid of running out of anything. Oh, we need to be afraid about not getting our act together and creating the solutions we know are possible.
And
so let's focus on creating the solutions.
Let's not focus on
and
Phil. Let's not focus on Phil.
I'm sorry.
Because that's a bad energy.
It's a bad energy.
Dark matter.
That is dark matter.
All right. So whatever it's worth, I would like to propose just a supposition that maybe it is here, but it's on other frequencies, other octaves, and we have the capacity to tap into it.
It's a different radio channel. Like, you know.
It's a different octave on the piano. It's high C, high C. It's just a different octave, different frequency range. Whatever it's worth. I just want to lay some of those things out there, and if it resonates with you, that's great, that's fine too. The most important thing I want to do here is run through a number of people I consider to be seminal thinkers and see if I can just give you a couple paragraphs on what I understand them to have found and what some of the implications may be for food and growing food and potentially ourselves as well. So, first one I've got here is a woman named Maylon Ho. She's the founder of an organization called the Institute of Climate Society. She coined the term quantum jazz to refer to what's going on a vibrational level in every single one of our cells all the time. So, I think she said it was 26 different octaves of jazz. But basically, every single compound in our cells vibrates at the speed of 1 times 10 to the negative 14th of a second. How many vibrations per second is that? A very big number, right? The speed of vibration of everything in all of our cells, in the living systems, is extraordinarily rapid. And not only is it vibrating rapidly, but every time a new mineral or a new compound enters the cell, everything morphs, right? Like as in jazz, everybody modulates to get in tune with that new frequency that just entered the cell. Mm-hmm. So the speed of vibration and modulation is extraordinarily rapid in living systems. It's not stable, static matter. It's vibration. It's this interplay and modulation of vibration that's going on. And it happens at an extremely rapid rate. That's the most important point I want to make here is the rate at which this is occurring. And perhaps, this can help explain the modality by which things like, I have written down here, foliar sprays and prayer work. How is it that we can, connect with a plant and have it, change its structure? People heard about these things with the plants that open doors for them and sing and stuff like that. Heard about these things?
Secret
plants? There's you can, who is that? What's that person?
Italy.
There's a potential community, Dalinger, has a, a YouTube, Dalinger singing plants.
How do you spell it?
D-A-M-A-N-H-U-R, I believe. Dalinger. People have hooked up plants to, automatic door openers and the plant that recognizes you, when you walk up to the door, it'll sense your presence and send out a jump in energy which could turn on the door open. So your plant, your house plant, is literally opening the door for you.
That's
potato battery or something?
What's that?
It's like a Martin potato battery.
Potato battery, something like that. Look it up.
Yeah, I think some of the books you have are the fields of which you talks about how the plants can be
online. Yes. That seems like a plant. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Well, there was a study 2 weeks ago that said that that actually plants attract bees through a frequency. It's not only the center, the shape of the flower, but the frequency of the flower actually changes.
It's the color, the frequency of the color of the petals. Frequency is the way life communicates. Frequency is simply the way life communicates. End of story. There's also the studies. University of New Hampshire did a study where they had, ash trees in greenhouses, and they introduced an ash borer into one greenhouse onto one tree, and it sent out a whole slew of chemical compounds that that made it less digestible to the ash borer. And also, interestingly, all the rest of the trees in that greenhouse did at the same time, even though the borer was not touching those trees. And also, interestingly, the ash trees in the other greenhouses that were separate and totally, totally climate controlled, no air.
Not connected by mycelia.
No. Separate trees in separate greenhouses also all had that same hormone, compound shift happen when that one ash borer was put on the one ash tree. And there's dozens and dozens of formal scientific studies that are showing that there's a frequency going on, a frequency communication going on. We'll talk about insects here next. Okay, let's go to the insects. But I want to make one point about foliar sprays. Has anybody here played with foliar sprays and something to do amazing things? Not yet? Anybody?
A little bit.
Played with foliar sprays?
A little bit.
I've seen foliar sprays, I've seen...
Yeah.
Apply a foliar spray, 2 days, 3 days later, you've got ridiculous amounts of new growth. Absolutely unjustifiable based on the amount of material you apply to that plant. There's no way in physics that amount of material can cause that amount of growth.
I've done it with compost teas.
Absolutely.
And found, like, yeah, really, really good.
Ridiculous response. Really, what's really going on?
Yeah.
And what I would suggest is that foliar sprays are the peak, the top of the pyramid, that, you know, your soil testing and mineral balancing is the foundation, your conductivity is the middle, and foliar sprays are the peak. And you can get a response to the foliar spray whenever you want, but if you don't have the foundation in place, it'll fall away in a few days. If you want to have that effect hold and then be able to build on that, you have to have the foundation in place. But it's a very powerful.
Might it also be that you're paying attention?
Through foliar spray. That's why I said foliar spray.
Okay. I see you. I see you need something. Maybe if you just put a little water or hibiscus tea, it might work as well.
Or just even the thought of a homeopathic remedy.
I'm wondering. It's our way of saying we care about you. We're putting all this foliar spray on.
That way you wouldn't have to get out of bed. In fact, I've had a couple of stories about people doing that in the middle of tomato plants. Who just sat and meditated with their tomato plants and said, you know, what do you need?
We care about you.
No, like really a deep connection. Not just, a general statement, but like at the range where you're actually communicating, right? I mean, like, that takes a level of subtlety and capacity to be able to do that, but actually ask the tomato plant what it wants, how it's doing. It tells you, I need 24. Just project 24 at me. Okay, here's 24. I don't know why. You know, I need chrysanthemums. Good. Got it. Here's the energy of chrysanthemum. You don't actually need the material to get the response. But then again, that breaks all the rules of our physical world. Oh, wait, Einstein said it all matter was energy, like 110 years ago, right? We still haven't figured out that actually it's all energy. If you want to out-compete the Monsantos, if you've got a serious strategic objective, which is to create alternative reality, you need to use the leverage available to you. And the leverage we have, the power we have of life and living systems and how they really work, means that we can actually help farmers produce crops at a much lower cost of production, which means their economic viability is much higher. If we've got a problem with people being fat and stupid and sick, we need to get better food into their bodies and take responsibility for it, logistically, with leverage and intelligence and strategy. And, you know, look, he was a formerly entomologist at the University of Florida for, I'm not sure how many years, 20, 30 years, entomologist of insect bugs. As an entomologist at the University of Florida, all of his research is still classified by the U.S. military. We can't read any of it. It is off limits for civilians because he was studying their antenna and frequencies and energy. How the insect antenna are designed, how they work as energy receivers and propagators, right? Remember the old days when people had radio and TV antennas, TV antennas in their houses? Yeah. That's what insect antenna are doing. They're picking up frequencies in the environment. And at any rate, Phil Callahan was the first one who formally identified that, proved that was how insects actually identify their mates and their foodstuffs. If you understand that nitrogen is a frequency, it's a compound but also a frequency, and a plant's leaf that has high levels of nitrate in it is going to be projecting a frequency of nitrate, and your insect antenna is tuned to 88.5, the frequency of nitrate, then that is how the insect finds the crops that are edible for it. And when your plant leaf has protein, which is a different frequency, and is propagating that frequency out, the insect antenna is not tuned to that frequency, and so it doesn't see that leaf. Right? That makes sense?
Yes.
On some real basic, like, oh my God, that's a really good way to design it. Like, who thought about that? That's a really good way to design it. Anyway, and those pheromones, we say they smell with their noses. Do you hear about this thing? They smell the pheromones from 3 miles away. You ever hear about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ridiculous. Preposterous.
I had a roof deck on an apartment in Newtown.
Yeah.
And I started planting things. Like, I had bumblebees and dragonflies and ladybugs galore.
and
show up out of the blue.
Praying mantis.
Out of the blue.
Yeah, I was like, where did
they were never there before.
No, never. Where did they? If I was in New Jersey and there was a fence between my yard and the other guy's yard, and they could go, okay, I'll shut everything here.
Yeah.
But I was like, really on the seventh floor of the airport with no other, there's no way around me anywhere. And
yeah.
Suddenly
it
I
just happened by?
Yeah. And I was like,
just when you planted your plants. Life works, you know, through this electromagnetic spectrum. That's the way life works. And, you know,
that's just because maybe the bees can't see the flowers if they're not, if they're doing chemicals, agriculture, they just can't see them. It might just be as simple as that.
Well, a low brix plant has flowers that bees won't land on. They can read the value of the sap by looking at the frequency of the flower and see whether it's worth stopping and harvesting that pollen out. It's very simple. It's very simple. And this is the way insects and life do. So, Bill Callahan identified this formally as an entomologist, whatever it's worth. If you were to take this information and go to Cornell, they'd laugh at you. They've done it to me at UMass a couple of times. But, you know, whatever. They're wrong. So, it's the literature is there, the science has been proven, this is the way things actually work. Right? If you have a glass wall, and a female insect over here, and a male insect over there, and there's no way for the pheromones to get through the glass wall, and still they're attracted to each other, how is it happening?
Shallow.
What's that?
Very shallow.
Very shallow. I'm not sure I properly got that. That's fine. All right. Anyway, my next one is paramagnetism. Bill Callahan again. Paramagnetism is a force that I wish I understood more well. Until about page 11. A paramagnetic material is one whose charges will align in the presence of a applied field. So, what does that mean? That's the formal definition. A paramagnetic material is one whose charges will align in the presence of an applied field. So, take for instance a magnetic field. You take a material which is, like a rock, and you want to magnetize it, and some of the charges in that rock line up and follow the magnet. That would be a paramagnetic material. And basically, we have a very interesting correlation between soil paramagnetic charge and plant vigor in that soil. This is across the board, a very, very interesting correlation. I have found that when I cheat and get some basalt from a local quarry and spread it gratuitously on my fields, but where I have spread lots of paramagnetic basalt, my plants have vigor that is just quite stupefying. Not to mention it's highly productive and lucrative.
Where do you get them?
What's that?
Mount
Tom in East Hampton, Mass. is where I get mine from. I've got about 40 tons in my front yard. Anybody wants to come and take some home? I'm serious. Literally 40 tons in my front yard. Take it home if you can carry.
How many? You've got
a dump truck? Fill it up.
So is it magnetic? Can you put a magnet to it?
It's paramagnetic. It's not ferromagnetic. Above a certain level of paramagnetism, you get ferromagnetism. It's basically the gradient of magnetic susceptibility.
How did you get it to your yard?
I ordered it.
40?
It was two dump trucks. Two dump trucks.
It doesn't
look like
your
No. No, it doesn't hold a charge. The charges will align in the presence of an applied field. So the thing is that we always have an applied field. It's called Earth's magnetic field. Right? On the planet Earth, we've got an applied field. And the more paramagnetic our soil is, the more the charges align, the more current seems to run through your soil.
How do you know if something's paramagnetic?
You get a little paramagnetic meter.
What is that for?
That was expensive. If anyone's got a sample, send me a sample. I'll test it for you.
Do you have one?
I do.
How much is a small, like a handheld?
Film canister size sample.
No. I'm saying if you wanted to get the instrument, like how much would maybe like a handheld, a small paramagnetic?
$400
meter. Okay.
Send it to him.
send me a sample.
Do you use that for the toy? What do you use that for?
Right now, I lent it to a friend, and he's using it to suss out all the quarries in the Northeast U.S. We're telling people that we're trying to find local sources of stone dust, and they're sending him samples, and he's running through, you know, prospecting assays and checking the gravity land charge and trying to build a sort of a database of what local rock materials are available to people around the region. So, he's got it. But
when and how do you use the salt for your
stuff? Heavily, probably in the fall. Well, 2 to 3 tons per acre is a base application rate, 10 tons per acre is not unreasonable. 10 tons per acre, it's not a big pile, actually. I had arugula that's still growing. It's right now, it's about somewhere 4 and 5 feet tall, that I planted in June. This is now, tomorrow will be...
Through winter,
it
kept growing?
Well, here's what happened. I thought I was going to build a big, like, geodesic dome sort of greenhouse thing in my yard. I didn't get around to doing it, but I did throw a bunch of rock dust down there because I was planning to put them in there, and I hadn't gotten it built, and I needed a space to put my arugula in the middle of summer, and so I planted my arugula there. And it was the beginning of a drought, and my spring was drying out, and I barely got it watered a couple times to germinate, and then didn't water it again through July and August. I got 6 pickings off of it. One bed, 84 feet long, 4 feet wide. One bed, 85 feet long. I made $2,500 on one planting arugula. Six pickings. No watering in the drought. No flea beetles. I built a little something in front of my house, and when I built the planting bed, I needed some dirt for it, so I went out and told the guys to go out and give me some dirt. They went out and they just dug it up. They dug up all the arugula dirt and threw it in the planting bed. So the plants, the arugula plants that were close on to the top, you know, turned around, and this was like in November, just turned around and went up. And they've been growing all winter long in my sunroom, and they're, you know, well, they're not, because the planting bed is 2 feet tall, they look like this to me, but they're, you know, well over 4 feet tall right now. They've been going for 7 or 8 months. I mean, after I made $2,500 off one bed. So that's just one this year experience with paramagnesium.
You put it under the soil?
Mix it in. Mm-hmm. Yep. You can certainly take paramagnetic rock and put it underneath a planter. If you've got planters doing rooftop stuff, if you're going to be putting in a base to a rooftop garden or a base to a planting bed somewhere, building gardens on, what is it? Rubble? I'd put some paramagnetic stone dust on top of my rubble. That'll just make whatever it'll just make your plants grow better. So it's a cheat. It's like cheating, basically. It's like one of those little secret things you never knew, but try it out and see what happens. You're like, okay.
Carefully
at $4 a ton.
Oh my
God, that would be awesome.
It's stone dust.
Can we?
It's a byproduct.
Can
they dump
it. Money from
what's that? You guys can just get a truck and come get some goodies. I mean, that's a stockpile. Or you can self-organize a depot down here. And our organizational strategy is to put together depots of, you know, minerals and people educating and organizing all of this. Decentralized, self-organized, implement. Yes. What's that?
Is there readings on this?
Paramagnetic meter?
Yeah, I mean, all this paramagnetic.
He's got a book over there.
Basically, like, you know, if your soil is above 250 or 300 on the paramagnetic charge, you're in good shape. You know, 400 to 700, you're like rocking. Most soil is probably 25 to 100.
But like any literature?
Paramagnetism, I got a couple books on here. But look up paramagnetism, just to Google paramagnetism. Formal, there's tons of science on paramagnetism. Not a hell of a lot on the agricultural applications of it, but it's a very well recognized, you know, force in science. Okay, next one I've got, Lewis Kirkland. Biological Transmutation is the name of his book. Member of the French Academy of Science, the New York Academy of Science. He started out his career on the oil platform in French Algeria. This is the 50s when Algeria still belonged to France. And the people working on the oil platform were black Africans. So therefore, they could do experiments on them. And so he was doing experiments on them. And what he was doing was measuring everything that came into their bodies and everything that came out of their body. Right? Everything they're eating and everything that's coming out. Urine, feces, you know, sweat, everything. And he was monitoring over time, you know, what was going on. And he had this unfortunate situation that began to occur where he had, I can't remember, was more potassium coming in? I think it was more potassium coming in than going out, and more sodium going out than coming in. He's like, okay, you know, I noticed this minor difference this week, and then he saw it next week, it was still there, and next week it was still there, and after 2 months, he's like, uh-oh, there is a serious potassium, you know, deposit being built somewhere in people's bodies, and where is the sodium coming from? You know, if their blood gets out of balance, they're going to be dead. Really concerned, started, you know, chopping them up, looking around, couldn't find a potassium deposit, couldn't find where the sodium's coming from. Scratching his head for 2, 3, 4 months into this thing, and we got a serious, you know, mineralogical imbalance set up now over time, and can't find it. And then finally looked at the atomic weight of everything and realized that there was as many protons and neutrons coming out as going in. They were just coming out in a different atomic form than they came in. And so that was, you know, seminal insight or experience that caused me to think things. There's lots of data about this transportation. I don't think it was killing anybody, but it was some minor surgery involved. Yes. What's that?
Someone, but whatever.
Yeah. The Irish got pretty poorly treated for a while, too. Lots of people were treated poorly. Anyway, all we can do is what we can do. So the insight here is that living systems seem to be able to play with protons and neutrons the way we play with electrons. Living systems can, in fact, he put together a bunch of nice recipes there in his book. It's right over there if you want to read it. Biological transmutations. Silicon plus magnesium equals calcium, for instance. You can take the calcium out of a chicken's diet and keep it out of the diet until the eggs are coming out with no shell, just a little skin. Where are some of those eggs? You know what I'm talking about. Okay, so it'll happen. The chicken will lay an egg with no shell. It's just like this, like skin, basically. And then you add mica to the chicken's diet, which contains no calcium, and within 24 hours, the next egg that comes out has a full calcium shell on it. This has been done dozens, hundreds of times. This is just a fact of life, that life has figured out how to play with protons and neutrons so they can move from one atomic form to another in a way that we can't do outside of a nuclear reaction. And this is my root argument for how we can not need to amend our soil if it's functioning well. Life has figured out how to take raw rock and make out of it all the minerals that it needs to function, it seems to be. And so my suggestion is if we can create an environment where life is flourishing well in our soil, it will manufacture all the minerals we need out of the raw materials in the soil. Does that make sense to me? People are seeing it all plausible. I mean, how does life take these random rock, you know, deposits and make balanced soil out of everything? Ever wonder about that? I mean, you got your basic rock mineral over here. And, you know, it's basalt there, it's granite there, it's limestone here, and life seems to make soil out of it everywhere. And you can look at the basic paramaterial and see what the mineral spectrum is, and then you can see what the soil is. And you got to wonder where the minerals in that soil came from if they weren't in that original mineral spectrum. I mean, just the basic logic of it. So, for me, I mean, it seems to be that the data and the concept can fit together here nicely. So, my argument is we do not need to be systemically adding things to the soil over time. We can simply revitalize the soil, reinvigorate it in a short period of time, and if we manage it well, not need to supplement thereon. I'll make my point about not feeling limited over there. We don't need to be afraid of limitations and running out of things. If we're in harmony with life, we have everything we possibly need. Okay, some will think of Lynn McTaggart. Lynn McTaggart, my understanding is basically an investigative reporter who has gone around seeking the brains of people who will be doing some cutting-edge science and figuring out what it is exactly what they're saying. The book of hers that I have over here called The Field, very interesting, a number of insights in there from, research that's no more than 50 or 20 years old. Stuff that won't be in the science textbooks for another 10 years, won't be in a common, understanding for another 20 years after that. Basically, what it seems to be saying is that the brain functions as a field antenna. We do not actually store memories in our brain. Our brain is an antenna that looks back into the field to see the ripples of what happened, and we read the ripples. I'm not sure if that explained that well. If I was to throw a rock into a lake, a still lake, and you were to walk around a corner 15 seconds later, or 5 seconds later, and look out at the lake, you could pretty well surmise what happened without seeing it. Right? You can see the ripples coming out. You can see me standing there. You can see what just happened by reading the ripples. Now, every single thought, every single action, every single thing that ever happened sends out a ripple, basically, into the universe. And what the argument here is being made, it's not an argument, it seems to be the data, is that the brain is an antenna that's tuning to exactly what just happened and reading it. That's what the Sanskrit yogis called the Akashic record, Akashic field. Steiner, when asked where he got all the information, said, well, it was the Akashic record, obviously. Where else would you look? I mean, this is basically cutting-edge 20th century science seems to be saying. But because they can't find it with short memories, anybody been following this? I've got three cousins that are PhD neuroscientists, randomly, on both sides of the family. And I tease them, like, so where exactly do we start memories? I'm like, oh, well, we haven't quite found it yet, exactly. And they can't find where we start memories because we don't store them. They're not stored.
They only know the parts of the brain that are activated when you're trying to recover.
Yes, exactly. But they can't find the memories themselves because they're not theirs.
Lenny McTaggart also, she's the one who did the big intention experiments, right, where they actually had people who they scientifically could show that they were affecting something either a different day or like halfway across the world. And they actually did it at intervals so that they could actually measure when the people were actually sending the intention and they were like trained.
Yeah.
The same person worked
on? Lynn McTaggart. She's a really interesting person. For whatever it's worth, I think it's damn intriguing.
So it could explain, when people have had an amputation, they still feel an itch in their arm or whatever?
Maybe, I guess. I hadn't thought about that one. It explains how you can, know something happened. Somebody got hurt. Something's happened to someone.
Or
you know it, right? You know something's happened?
Yeah.
We're taught that we have 5 physical senses. Right? Right? That you know, smell, touch, taste. Yeah. Which one was that? As soon as that happens, you can throw out that theory of 5 physical senses. Mm-hmm. Right? As soon as something happens that is outside of that spectrum of this is the theory, that something happens that proves that theory is not true, throw it out. It's false. Right? It's not true that we only have 5 physical senses. We have much more than that.
When you're
Julius Caesar,
you have the memories
because
they're coming from this
exactly. Akashic. Exactly. Anyway, okay, Lynn McTaggart. And the last thing I want to say here is that Steiner said that the roots are the brains of the plant. I think this root structure looks very interestingly similar to the brain structure, and I'd like to propose that the plant is also picking up frequencies from the environment, both of its roots and with its leaves. And that's part of the way the plant is dealing with its environment, is through frequencies to its antenna function and system. The next one here, Stephen here at Buhner, he very nicely lays out the science behind our three neural nodes, our three organs in our body. We have a preponderance of brain cells, neurons. You know, three neural nodes in our body, three brains.
Yes. Our gut.
The gut, the head, the brain, and the heart. You've got three. The uterus. Fair enough. You're obviously smarter than we are.
It's the same muscle material as the heart.
It's brain. It's
the heart and the uterus.
And the uterus.
The same muscle.
Yeah. I've done not at all the price.
So some indigenous people will say, and women have two hearts. They have phrases.
Yeah. I'm not at all surprised. At any rate, the point that Stephen Harbino was trying to make here was that each of these neural nodes, each of these sets of brain cells has a frequency associated with it, and wherever we turn our attention is where which one is dominant. And so if we turn our attention to our brain and our mind, then the heart frequency, the gut frequency, interacts to the brain frequency. But the brain frequency is the dominant frequency. And, in our culture, we're taught that we think with our head, and we're not even told that we've got other brains, other modes of perception and understanding and intuition. So we don't even know to listen or to feel or to, sense. But his point was basically for us to be balanced, we have to be working out of our heart center primarily and let the brain and the gut entrain with the heart. So if people know how to take a deep breath and just turn your attention to your heart as opposed to thinking with your head, that is the mode that I would suggest you should be in when you're dealing with your plants. When you're dealing with living anything, animals, but specifically plants, they're very receptive, they're very sensitive. And which mode of perception you're in will have an effect on those plants. Maybe a tenuous connection to growing things, but I think it's relevant nonetheless. Richard Ulrey, my next one here. Minerals for the genetic code. So when the Human Genome Project was being done, when they were mapping the human genome, they had to identify all the enzymes, or they did identify all the enzymes that are used to build every strand of DNA. Are you okay with that? DNA is built with enzymes. You know what enzymes? Lock and key. Yes, no, maybe. Brains are fried. So they listed all the enzymes, and once we have all the enzymes listed, we can see what all the minerals are that are at the core of those enzymes. Interestingly, there are 56 different elements that are required to replicate every strand of DNA. 5, 6. Copper, zinc, boron, manganese, cobalt, indium, selenium, chromium. Keep going for a long time. And that's how many are used 4 billion times every day just to maintain your body. Have you heard about the effect of your new body every 6 months?
Yeah.
That your flesh, your liver, your kidneys are replaced every 6 months. Your bones take a little while longer. But you basically are constantly, your body is constantly renewing itself. Old cells are being disassembled. New cells are being assembled. The math is you get basically 4 billion new cells every day. And at the center of every cell is a strand of DNA. And it takes 56 different elements, to replicate every strand of DNA, meaning that 4 billion times every day. When you don't have all 56 different elements that you need, the enzymes aren't there. When the enzymes aren't there, those pieces of DNA are not put together properly, right? They're called, they're basically functionally, they're breaks in the DNA. They're called genetic markers. You know what about genetic markers? We found 34 new genetic markers for, this came out 2 days ago, for colon cancer and breast cancer. And, yeah. So they identify genetic markers or breaks in the DNA that correlate with these diseases. What's interesting is, I'll take chromium as an example. If you don't have chromium in your body, and you don't have the chromium-based enzymes when your DNA is replicating itself, you have what they call genetic markers for diabetes. The correlation between chromium and diabetes. Now, if you add chromium to your body, slowly, supplement over time. The next time those cells replicate themselves, if they have chromium available to them, that genetic marker gets fixed. So all the baloney about genetic markers is so ridiculous. It's preposterous. But the correlation with genetic markers and nutrition is direct. You want to address your genetic markers? Don't take some fancy expensive drug. Eat well. I mean, we can systemically solve these things, these degenerative diseases, through nutrition. Through providing complete comprehensive nutrition in our diet, we can rebuild healthier bodies. That's the science. I think it's extremely inspiring. The potential to empower is dramatic. So whatever it's worth. Yes.
Can I just 15 minutes? Can you get to the next?
Is it 4:15?
4:30.
It's 4:30. All right, Wilhelm Reich. Anybody here know Wilhelm Reich? The same suspects back there. There's always a few people with
He's the one who made the machine, right?
Plumbed the libraries. What's that?
The machine, you go inside and they give...
Exactly. The hormone generator?
Yeah.
You get cloud clusters?
Right.
Yeah, you could, it's like, oh, you want some sunlight? Here. Waves, the clouds just sort of melt away. He's like, oh, you want the rain? Turn it around. The rain kind of right. Absolutely. Okay, so Wilhelm Reich, student of Freud's. He and Jung were sort of two of Freud's best students, is my understanding. My wife, who's from India, learned about Wilhelm Reich in ninth grade science class because he is the first Western scientist to have proved the existence of what the Chinese call qi, what the Indians call prana. He called it orgone or bions, but he formally isolated it and proved it, I don't know, 1940s, 1950s, 30s? A while ago. 40s? Yeah.
And they shut him down.
What's that?
And they shut him down and they...
Locked him up, burned his books, and he died in prison. I think what happened. Yeah.
In Germany?
Close.
No.
Now here.
Yeah,
in Germany? He's got the money.
He was in Germany.
They took all the hospitals and doctors from over here.
Very happy.
Anyway, okay. So whatever it's worth, I'd like to suggest that I think that we can have the capacity to perceive these things directly. I believe I can and do, and I think other people probably can and do also. Has anyone ever looked at a tree line a couple hundred yards away or quarter mile away and seen like a little line of white above the trees? Like it's blue, and there's trees, and there's this little white line in the middle. What the hell is that? Where'd it come from? I want to hazard a guess. What's going on? What are you seeing? I would suggest that's the aura of the trees, but that may just be me. Has anybody ever looked into the sky? I find it, it's difficult to see here in the city, but, if you are out something resembling nature, and you just look out, it's possible,
it's a 10 acres.
Good.
Wow.
You got 110 acres. You can go run around naked and go swimming wherever you want.
It's still a
space. You don't have 110 acres.
It's still mine.
Yeah. Bonfires, hoedowns.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So what do you see when you
gotta be careful.
There's these little squirrelies that's... You people never see those little squirrelies?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The little squirrelies
in the air. They're like little, it's like the air is like, it's like brighter. But the little bright dot surface is spinning really fast.
Numerous of them.
You can see them. After a fresh snow, you see them on the snow. What are those things?
So you can see them directly, they're not infrared.
No, you see them directly. You focus your eyes and you see them.
In the air.
Exactly. Right. They spit. Yeah, exactly.
So do you hear them? Can you grab them?
I've never tried to grab them. It's hard enough to focus on. When you do focus on them, you find that this part of your forehead begins to experience strong sensation. Well, I call it thorax. But No, I mean, we'll have Rank identify this formally. A lot of us see these things. We don't have a name for it, so we don't talk about it. We don't recognize it. We don't train each other about these things. I would suggest we have all these capacities. We've got all the functionalities. The science proves this is true. And because we don't talk this language with each other, we don't share it, we don't discuss it, we don't train with each other, we're walking around like dithering idiots, basically. You know, we have this functional capacity, we're not developing it, we're not, you know, communicating it and sharing it. For whatever it's worth, I think it's cool that chi and prana have been formally proved, and that a lot of us have the sensation of the experience of seeing things that seem to resemble the definition that Wright laid out when he wrote up his text on what bhyāna is worth. So,
what's that still available?
Can be found, yes. The International Society of Orgonomy meets every year, it was in June, in Rangeley, Maine. We live in Maine, so if you ever want to go and meet some cool people. Another cool organization is the American Society of Dowsers. They meet up north in Vermont at the beginning of June, for sure. There's a bunch of cool people there.
We actually have a meeting in this neighborhood.
There's local chapters around, but the national gathering is a
it's right in this neighborhood.
ASD, American Society of Dowsers. Bunch of kooks. Cool people. Really cool people. Okay, Steiner. Steiner, I don't know enough about Steiner to really speak to. Thoroughly intelligently. I have not talked about the Biogenic Cleansing Calendar. I pay close attention to my Biogenic Cleansing Calendar. I want to know whether the moon is in a, from my perspective, between us and a water sign or us and a fire sign when I'm planting my crops. Because I'm going to plant my leaf crops when the moon is in a water sign, and I'm going to plant my fruit crops when the moon is in a fire sign, and so on and so forth throughout the entire year. What's that? Absolutely. There's no question about the, you know, good sense in paying attention to God's planting calendar.
Did you say that again?
Absolutely.
Is there a fire sign in the moon?
Just get the book. Fruit in the fire, leaves in the water, roots in earth. You can be crushed.
You can buy the calendar online from the Piper
Books. Stella Natura is the one I get. It costs like $13.
Yeah.
If you read it, it'll lay everything out. Okay, that's one thing I want to say. Indigenous cultures all over the world pay very close attention to where the moon's at, and all over the world. We don't pay attention to our detriment. The higher your organic matter in your soil, the more effect the moon's forces have on your soil. The lower your organic matter, the less effect the moon's forces have. One more point I want to make about Steiner. My understanding is that one of his students, Aaron Reed Piper, who I think the Piper Center's name, which is close here, at one point asked Steiner, why is it that when we sit to meditate and we're able to achieve somewhat elevated to consciousness, we cannot maintain them going through the day? When we get up, we're done meditating, we go out to our daily work, and we lose that state of centeredness and blissfulness. Why can't we hold it? And Steiner said, because our food does not have enough soul force. Now, I don't know what soul force is, but I'd like to propose perhaps it's a coherent vibration of the minerals that, you know, actually build coherence in our bodies. That's just a supposition. Okay, moving along quickly. Bill Mollison did Holmgren permaculture. I think a lot of the principles of permaculture are things that people who are growing crops need to understand. I'll just accentuate right here the multi-speciation intercropping, so having more than one, ideally more than two species of plants growing in close proximity to each other, A, and B, reducing tillage. Whenever you till the soil, you cause genocide. You are responsible for the death of billions and trillions of living organisms every time you till the soil. And that is deeply destructive to the vitality of the plants you're growing. Understand, you are causing genocide every time you till the soil, period. The question is the order of magnitude.
Dan?
Yes?
I don't want to take up time, but can you say one sentence about the care of our perennials and pieces of your system?
You damn well better do a good job putting them in the ground. We've been doing it for 30 years.
They're in there. They're all in there already.
Yeah, okay. When you're transplanting, especially things like trees, the more perennial they are, they will have a major root moving out to the side. That should be magnetic north. The big root that goes out sideways, when the plant germinated, was running due north. And if you put that in southeast, you're going to have a tree with vertigo. All these principles are directly applicable. Nutrition, conductivity, bricks, foliar spring. There's no difference between arugula and apples and blueberries across the board. Yes. It's unnatural for trees to be dug up and moved. It's unnatural for trees to be grafted. If I wasn't chop your head off and put somebody else's on, we can do the transplant, right? We can do the transplant, but how is that really going to work for you?
Keep people alive. People get a kidney transplant and keep them alive for 20 years. That's not too bad.
But from the perspective of...
Doesn't mean they were healthy people, necessarily.
The perspective of vigor and vitality in the tree. If you want to have high-quality fruit from a healthy, vigorous tree, understand what you did to it. And understand the effect that that's going to have on the vigor and the vitality.
She might get a big fruit that's full of sugar, but not much protein or those other phytonutrients here.
Yeah. Diseases because sure. your plant's immunity and vigor will never be as high as it was before it got sliced in half.
I just want to say it can be really hard if you're a commercial grower or if you're buying really any tree seedlings from most commercial
anyone,
growers
anywhere
where most of them are grafted on a dwarfing rootstock,
the top is always going to be bigger than the bottom. You have hormone imbalance set in from the beginning.
So would you say instead we should?
I think you should get high quality seed and put them in the ground like where you want the tree to be.
Yeah. Like awesome heirloom.
Take your time.
Open poly.
Exactly.
That will be okay. Yeah.
Right, so when you put an orchard in, plant it for at least 2 or 3 years.
Do a
good job because once it's in, you're committed to it for decades.
Yeah.
It's not like tomatoes. If it's going to die, you get a better shot next year. This guy's going to kick me out here. About to kick me out.
Apples are heterozygous, right? Five seeds from one apple will produce plants that don't resemble a pair.
Yes.
Right?
There are some sports that will come true. I don't know enough about this to speak really totally intelligently about it. But I know that it's the seeds from, you know, you can get seeds that will cause, you know, big, beautiful, amazingly strong trees that are highly productive.
I wonder what that means, for example, about apples, though, right? Pretty much all of the commercially available apples are grafts because of that, because you can't reproduce as old and delicious.
Sometimes they will produce, sometimes they won't, A.
Okay.
And B, most commercial apples are grown on dwarfing rootstock, so that you can get a return in short order, not to wait 20 years to get your maturity in the orchard. So, I mean, I'm not sure how much of it has to do with the genetics, how much of it has to do with the logistics of the management. A true apple will be a big tree, you know, 40, 50 feet across, if given the space. And the way apples are grown now, they've got 6 feet.
Right.
And they want to be ready in 5 years. And so I think that's the major reason for the dwarfing rootstock.
It's also just because people like, you know, humans like certain varieties that you can only produce by through a graft.
All right, no more questions until I get done. So we can. Kerry Means, brilliant individual, founder of this thing called the Reams Biological Theory of Ionization, RBTI. I suggest if anybody knows anybody who's sick and doesn't want to be, like, seriously sick, like, you know, precancerous, cancerous, things like that, and does not want the conventional treatment, look up RBTI. They have testers who are they're not doctors, because they would get locked up if they said they were. But they use a refractometer and a conductivity meter. And they test your urine and saliva.
What is it?
RBTI, Reams Biological Theory of Ionization. They do the same thing with our urine and saliva that we're doing with the plant sap and soil solution. Conductivity and bricks. And you can use those basic tools to identify your imbalances and make and give very intelligent, systemic, strategic recommendations for what you need to do to get your energy back in balance. Very powerful. Reams was an agronomist. The refractometer, the chart, the Briggs chart, is the Reams chart. He was a student of Einstein's, a brilliant individual. No one that I've been able to talk to yet has been able to really properly explain what he was perceiving. He was obviously clairvoyant, but wherever he worked, he had brilliant success. He cured tens of thousands of people of late-stage cancer, like go home and die cancer. You're dead in 6 weeks, just go home and live your last weeks out, and then go to him, he tests their urine and saliva, put them on some limestone and lemon water, and they'd be better. Right? He predicts. Test your, he'd say, you're going to have a heart attack in the next 2 weeks and die if you're not careful. And the guy would say, who do you think he is? And he'd say, dead. Right? Really, really interesting fellow.
Where is he?
Where's Reams? He's dead. He died in 84. He's, you know, a lot of people around were students of his. 1 minute left. Okay. What's important is he said that minerals have male and female spins. That was how he managed to balance his soil tests, was by balancing the male and female elements. Some spin, the electron clouds spin in a clockwise direction, some spin in a counterclockwise direction. He said it was the balance of the spins that made the soil functional, vital. And for what it's worth, if you have a plant which is growing vigorously but not reproducing, not flowering and fruiting, using the female elements of phosphorus and manganese is a very good way to get them to reproduce, to flower and fruit. If you have a plant which is too small and not growing, it's starting to flower and fruit when it's too short, it's probably deficient in calcium and potassium from its male elements. This is a nice little cheat you can use to cause your plants to grow when they shouldn't. Okay, Nason's somatids basically was able to identify what appear to be total lines of life. If you want to know what a stem cell is, and that it can form into a liver or a kidney or a bone, Nason's was able to, it seems, identify stem cell lines of soil life. That basically the proto DNA in different environments will morph into different apparent to us species. Priscilla Hoff was another really good researcher studying this stuff 70 years ago. Okay, next topic, and seawater and humates and stone dusts all seem to have high levels of somatids in them, interestingly. Next one is cosmic pipes. So we understand that it's a bad idea to stand in front of a microwave. Yes?
Yes.
I said it's a bad idea to stand in front of a photocopier. We understand that cell phones wire our brains. Everybody's okay with this?
Yep.
The wireless, you know, the wireless wire your brains? Like you have 18 overlapping wireless signals? That's it. That's the worst part about this place. It's the overlapping wireless. It is killing us. If you understand the stuff wires your brain, right? We understand dissonant electromagnetic frequencies are detrimental to living systems. If you're okay with that, then you understand that that's part of reality. Then you understand that there must be a science for how you can create coherence.
Mm-hmm.
There is a science. You can take responsibility for your electromagnetic environment. There are tools, there's techniques, the science is out there. I give you three names, Gale Hieronymus, Hugh Lovell, and Bruce Tainio. Look out if you want. Cosmic pipes are used out in the middle of the Midwest. You plug one in the ground, you got a 5.5 mile radius, you know, coherency zone. There's some people doing some really interesting stuff. I would love to see it happen down here in the city. I think the city could very much benefit from it. The people here could benefit from it. Maybe even the consciousness here would benefit from it. A cosmic pipe is a name for a tool that is basically, you know, creates a coherent frequency zone in its environment, whether it's a quarter mile or 5 miles. They're called field tuners. They're called, slurgle phones. I mean, people name them all.
Slurgle phones.
That was a friend of mine named when I have a slurgle phone. Yes. Anyway. Okay. Last topic here is water. People familiar with Masaru Emoto? Yes. Here's some water. This guy was taking tap water and running it. This vial has fear written on it. This vial had love written on it. Ran tap water in both, froze them. The one with the love written on it had when it froze, it's beautiful crystal structure, Jack Frost would come to visit. And the one with fear written on it was just like this amorphous random crystal structure. The crystal structure of the water was different based on the word that was written on the tube. the consciousness, the intention, the water holds that intention and consciousness. This is why rainwater works better than tap water. Because tap water, because water, when water runs in nature, it's like this, right? Down a hillside, it's always going back and forth. Water never runs straight in nature. Look at a river, a river system, it's always going swirling back and forth across it. If you look at that swirling like this, in two dimensions, in three dimensions, it's like this. Water likes to spiral. And when you put water through straight lines, it loses all of its energy. So you put it through a pipe, and you kill it. It's dead. So you need to understand that while you can keep your plants alive and your soil alive with water during the summer, you're putting in, you know, dead energy water. And so the same way we can take responsibility for creating coherence with our electromagnetic environment, you can create coherence with your water by, you know, using various energizing tools to structure and energize it. So very simple. I don't have time to give this in more detail. I'm sorry I don't. I would strongly suggest looking into that if you're curious. Last two slides here, seawater and stone dust. My basic point in concluding is that it's my opinion that we have access to everything we need in locally across the planet to revitalize the planet. And this is totally doable for anybody and everywhere. And I hope that we can all take responsibility for trying this out ourselves. It seems inspiring and interesting. And if we get results, sharing those results with people and letting our actions speak louder than our words, manifest it. Figure it out, do it, and share it. I think if we can just walk this talk, we really can have a dramatic effect in solving a lot of the world's problems. We have lots of exciting things to do organizationally. We have an organization that's designed to do this. So if you are all interested, check out our website. We've got events and, you know, training courses and all this cool stuff. So thank you very much. I won't forget.
Everybody, at